Oh shit, we're live. Beatboxing. Brian Callen shows another hidden skill.
Damn straight,
baby. This last weekend, we just learned he speaks fluent gay rapist French.
Je parle français, c'est vrai, mon ami.
The hardest things I ever laughed at is you doing your French rapist character.
Yeah.
Talking to Steve Rinella about explaining to him how to, I'm assuming you were saying tighten up his ass because you were going to come inside of it.
Something
but you were
like
doing
that.
It all. You did it all in perfectly enunciated French.
That's right.
I think you shocked him.
I
think
did.
He did.
He
not
was crying.
Know.
He was laughing so hard he was actually crying.
The camera guy, the camera guys who are pros. These guys are goddamn pros.
Yeah.
They keep it together. The guy gave in and was laughing out loud while holding the camera. He's like, ah. He couldn't help it. We were all crying. And also, he knew this was never going to get on the fucking Sportsman Channel.
It's not going to get on the Sportsman Channel. Yeah.
But I wish they would release it on the web.
They should.
The Ravine comer.
Why don't we have those? The footage is there.
I think there's some concern that the hunting folk would abandon us.
Oh, because they don't like French rapists and ravine comers?
The folk don't like these goddamn comedians coming in and gaying up our fine American pastime. The hunting folk.
Oh, man.
Some of the hunting folk, look, most hunting people are like most people. Most people are cool as fuck. I maintain this. Mm-hmm. I really do believe this. I believe that most people are great. It is a very small percentage of people. It took me a long ass time to figure this out. Just the sheer numbers. It's just that when something goes wrong, it's so disturbing for us that we get upset and we lump all other folks into the same category that person came from, almost to protect ourselves.
Yeah.
And we, you know, it's a prejudice. And like having a prejudice towards people who live in the South, or having a prejudice towards, you know, anything. It's all the same. Any kind of prejudice. Like, it's not
against another team, their fans.
It's not a nicer prejudice because they just have a Southern accent. They live down there and you think it's cute to think they're retarded.
Right.
No, that's goddamn prejudice. Those are people.
Right.
If you thought they were retarded because they were black, you'd be a piece of shit.
Right.
Right? But you can think that they're retarded just because they talk like this. Like, some of them that talk like this are actually super intelligent people.
That's right.
Because they choose to keep their accent. I've spoken to professors that are like a strong Houston, Texas accent.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was genius as fuck.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Smarter than me.
We are tribal. People are just tribal. Yeah. It's really easy to do that. Those guys over there, I don't like people from West Virginia or whatever.
I don't like them goddamn comedians. They're smoking weed and they're talking hunting, and that's not what hunting's about. What hunting's about is how I do it.
Mm-hmm.
I get up in the morning and I face the east. Or is that Muslims?
No, that's Muslims. Now, see, now you're a traitor, and now you just exposed yourself.
No.
You exposed yourself.
I meant I praise Jesus to the east, west, north, and south.
No, you said the east. It means you're.
No. I'm not an. I swear to God, I am not a pale faced terrorist.
I think you are.
What is that? What is that expression? There's an expression. Oh, clean skin. Clean face? Clean skin terrorist?
I don't know. I haven't heard of it.
That expression is for like the Timothy McVeighs.
Oh.
The ones that you don't see coming, because they look like good old-fashioned American boys.
Yep.
Yeah, what is the term? See if you can find what that term is, Jamie.
Militia.
I think it's called clean skin terrorist. That's what they think of as like some homegrown nutty dude. I was listening to this fucking Radiolab podcast about these dudes, these white supremacist dudes that were planning this mass murder, and they were infiltrated by the FBI.
Jesus.
It was fascinating, man. God damn, that National Public Radio podcast, Radiolab, is one of the best things ever. Not just like on podcasts, but as far as like, as a movie, if it was a movie, it would be one of the best things ever. If it was a TV show, it would be one of the best things ever.
You turned me on two things when we were hunting. Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, I'm obsessed. By the way, you want to talk about a guy doing the world a service.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to learn history, and you're talking to a history major, I read all the books, blah, blah, blah. I take courses from the teaching company. If you want to learn history, go to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. I've listened to great professors. I've never heard anybody kind of break down history as a story where you just can't wait for the next podcast. And then Radiolab, which I've always listened to NPR, and sometimes they have those on there, but Radiolab is pretty amazing.
It's off the charts amazing. It's so good. So it is clean skinned. A clean skinned terrorist is a potential attacker with a spotless record whose documents don't arouse suspicion.
Wow.
Well, you got to think, like, every terrorist, every dude who blows a fuse, there has to be, like, there's a moment where you could get to like a certain age. You could be like pretty nutty and get to a certain age without a criminal record.
Yeah.
And then you're all the time, you're like building up for the one big nutty event.
Those are the scary guys that inside live inside. And then they're just waiting for action. Yeah. They're terrified, and they're fantasizing. They're going over in their head, and then they finally explode.
Now, how do those guys get made? Is that nature or nurture? Isn't that the ultimate question? Because if we could stop all people that would wantonly want to create war for profit, if we could stop all people that would act in the name of global aggression for financial gain, if we could stop all that, we would all do it. And then we would have a way crazier world. If we had a world where everybody was basically really nice.
Yeah. I mean, although you're suggesting in the way you frame that is you're assuming that people that are aggressive or create aggression or are the aggressors are doing it only for, a lot of people think this, only for certain negative things like money, conquest, territory. The problem is that aggression a lot of times can be fostered in groups of people if they think that another country is actually going to hurt them in the future. It can be very much useful in a self-defense capacity, or at least justified that way.
And always has been.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I don't think you'll ever get rid of aggression, and you probably shouldn't. I think it's part of the order of the universe. What I think you have to do is this. The biggest threat is, you know, one thing that's always kind of confounding about life is that it takes so long to build something. It takes so long to build a complete human being. It takes so long to build something like the Sistine Chapel. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to destroy. One motivated fanatic with a large enough bomb on his back could blow up, you know, St. Peter's Cathedral, or could kill I don't know how many people. And that's what's so hard, is that the things that take so long to build are so easy to destroy. And as technology grows, it's going to become more and more a factor and more of a reality where one person or a small group can get their hands on devastating technology to destroy, you know, something impossibly huge. So that's the bigger question. I think aggression is always going to be around. And when you say, you know, I wonder how those people are made, I don't know that it's going to be done by that one crazy, because one crazy can't get his hands on massive amounts of weaponry. He's usually one guy, and he carries a gun, and he does enough damage.
Well, how about these kids in the Boston bombings? I mean, they were fairly clean-skinned.
They were, and
right?
They didn't do... They killed, I think, 6 people. I can't remember what the thing is, but that's always tragic. What I'm saying is that the bigger threat is less aggression and more sort of warped ideology that moves and motivates a large group of people into aggression.
Right.
That's what I worry about. And that's where I think, you know.
So when you say aggression, you don't mean aggression like hostile takeover of countries type aggression. You mean just like male behavior? Like, what do you mean when you say aggression?
I think aggression in this context is...
It's like a military
typically
sense.
A military sense. Something that causes massive destruction, irreparable harm to infrastructure and to populations. And for example, what's going on in Iraq with ISIS, right? When you hear the news, if you just listen to the news, ISIS is this terrible group of fanatics. Yes, they are, and they kill lots of people. It's a much deeper problem. You know, they're talking about, what do you do about ISIS? Well, do you bomb the shit out of them? Problem is, they're ingrained in the Sunni towns and population, and they have a lot of support by the Sunnis. Why? Why do these fanatical guys have support from the Sunni population? Has nothing to do with whether those Sunni people who are good people, like you just said, most people are really good people, they are giving support to a fanatical group of people because they are their best hedge and their best bet against what's called Shia aggression in their eyes. Hmm. So the Shia who dominate the south of Iraq, who sit on most of the oil down there, if the Sunnis don't cut out a little place for themselves using this crazy group called ISIS, they could be left in the future in real fucking trouble. And so again, now we're talking about they're using aggression as a form of self-defense. If you were a Sunni Iraqi, you'd have a very different idea and context of what ISIS is, as opposed to you and I, who get our information. And again, there's nothing to admire about those guys. They're ruthless killers. But it's just interesting that you and I look at that as aggression on a one-sided. A lot of those people are using ISIS as self-defense. Aggression is justified. Yeah, they're terrible, but we need them against the Shia. So
it's hard for someone who lives in California in 2015 to wrap their head around what's going on in other parts of the world right now, unless you, I mean, even like what I've seen of it, I haven't seen enough. My seeing of it is all two dimensional. You know, I couldn't imagine. I couldn't fucking imagine. And it's one of the biggest problems we're going to have with people that have seen it and don't have to imagine it anymore. Mm. Trying to forget it. Trying to be normal again. I mean, you ask a fucking hell of a lot of people, and how do you help them through that? And what kind of counseling, mental health counseling? I mean, I hope it's comprehensive.
It's a really good question, because they always say after a war and after the revolution and after whatever happens in a country settles, everybody always forgets about the victims. There's never really any kind of infrastructure to help people in Sierra Leone that got their arms hacked off, that saw their kids killed in front of them and stuff like that.
Is it possible that because of the ability that we have right now to translate languages so quickly, you know, which is really unprecedented. Mm-hmm. It's something that people don't think about that much, but there's all sorts of software now, just on a regular phone, that can look at images and translate them to English on your screen. You could have ask questions and have those questions immediately translated into Spanish. There's all these programs they have now. Like, it's way easier to understand other languages than it ever has been before. Like, to decipher actual text in real time, that really never existed before.
No.
And that kind of technology is going to slowly but surely break down a lot of barriers and a lot of, like, ideas that we have about each other.
Well, less so language, and I think more so the fact that we can not only see suffering in real time with cameras and the internet, but we can also... We are also starting to see that cultures, whether they're Indian or South Korea, are really similar to Americans. You know, with K-pop, I mean, Korea's got all their K-pop and stuff. But more importantly, when you see their artistic expressions, they're making movies, Slumdog Millionaire. Mm-hmm. You see an Indian kid who has the same dreams and aspiration as anybody does. I think that goes a longer way in bringing people into sort of a collective notion. And it already has. People like Steven Pinker would argue that it's becoming easier to identify with other people's suffering, because we identify with a lot of aspects of how they live their lives to begin with. It's no longer like, who are those strange people with dark skin? Nowadays, you know, people are dressing the same no matter where you go. You know, I got recognized on the plane from a woman from Mumbai, because she watches How I Met Your Mother and told me all her friends love How I Met Your Mother. And she was flipping out that the guy from How I Met Your Mother was sitting next to her. And she had a heavy accent. She was, you know, talking like, I can't believe I'm watching, you know, it's unbelievable. Wow. We watch all my friends. Like, can I take a picture with you? She was so excited. Wow. And she had this heavy Indian accent. And I thought, that never would have happened.
No, you never know? Would have happened.
And so we are sharing artistic experience. We're sharing experience in high relief, usually in movies and TV. And that's, in a lot of ways, that's going to go a lot farther than being able to download a language, because I think that's always going to take more time.
Well, if we all just spoke the same language, it would be really fucking boring.
That's true.
But it would be really cool if we understood what the fuck everybody was saying all the time. Mm. You know, I think it would smooth out a lot of shit between people. I really got to think that, like, if we could have, like, real-time conversations with, like, Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
You know, if you could have a real-time conversation with that dude and sit down and go, what is your life like? Like, explain to me, like, what was childhood like for you? What's the environment around you all the time? Mm.
He's a real life king. Mm-hmm. He's a monarch, one of the few remaining. He's not.
Yeah.
That he lives like a king and was raised like a prince.
And Dennis Rodman's his homeboy.
Dennis Rodman was a great spokesman for him, wasn't he?
Dennis Rodman comes down and hangs with that dude and plays basketball and shit and then leaves. Like, what kind of fucking bizarro reality TV world are we living in, where Dennis Rodman just hops on private jets and hangs out with the king of North Korea?
Be the greatest reality show ever made.
I mean,
him and Kim Jong Un, me and the king.
It's like Rocky Marciano hanging out with Mussolini.
What do they talk about?
What do they talk about? Look at them there together, having a good old time. Do you think he's freaked out at all about the amount of metal that's in Rodman's face?
I know
that
I am.
Freaks him out?
God, look at that.
That is such a strange thing.
Yeah, look at him. He's a king.
I mean,
didn't he have his
God
uncle, his own uncle, eaten by wild dogs or something?
What?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
He assassinated him.
That's his uncle.
I was thinking about Rodman. No, I was like, Rodman did that?
Had his uncle killed.
I blame the weed.
Look at that.
Yeah, his uncle apparently was trying to organize a coup.
Yeah.
So he killed everyone. Everyone in the family except the wife. And he gave the wife like a raise.
Really?
Promoted her to a better position.
Really?
After he killed her husband. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Something along those lines. I might be making that up.
It's real Game of Thrones shit.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he really did kill his uncle and then his uncle's sons. So his uncle's sons couldn't take revenge on him.
Yeah.
Jesus.
The Russians were good at that. Jeez. Khrushchev and used to do that, and Stalin. And
oh, my God.
You get rid of everybody.
Yeah,
Saddam Hussein used to do that. Saddam Hussein, who was it who was talking about that? It was Helmut Schroeder, one of the ex-German premiers, went to meet. He said, I want to say hi to the ambassador, the German ambassador who I've known for 10 years. And they said he was unfortunately, he was executed for treason.
Whoa.
And he was like, he'd known him for a long time, and he was really kind of taken aback. And it's like, oh, that really makes me upset. And he goes, well, can I see the family? I got to know the family. I'd like to give them my condolences. The family is no longer around either. And he told that story. I think it was on Charlie Rose or something, where he went, oh, they killed his whole family. That's real. I mean, and again, like you were saying, we have no idea what it's like. We're so lucky. We're so lucky we can walk away from things we don't like, because most of the world has to live with something they don't like, including a government that tells them what to do and tells them where to live and tells them where they're going.
I don't know if this is propaganda or not. I don't know if it's bullshit or not. But I'm just telling you what I read, that they were putting people in jail if they didn't cry hard enough when Kim Jong-il died.
Yeah. Some of them were getting 6 months of hard labor, from what
I
read.
For not crying hard.
Yes, because they were not grieving hard enough. So you see these pictures of them beating their chest and crying, party members, crying for, you know, nobody wanted to be the first person to stop crying. So they're crying for hours.
Oh, my God. This is madness.
Yeah.
That's like group madness. Like, that's what North Korea is like group madness.
Yeah,
it's like you're watching what happens when you allow like these really ancient horrific methods of dictatorship.
And they do even worse. They, if you really fucked up, they'll put you in the coal mines, and you never leave. You never come out of the coal mine, so you don't get any sunlight. So your skin starts to fall off, but you don't leave. You're not getting up. You're living in the coal mine.
Oh my God,
it is so bad.
Punished for not crying. Thousands of North Koreans face labor camps.
6 months in labor. Yeah.
Oh my God, upset enough about the death of Kim Jong-il. That is insane. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Like, I guess that's the only way to run a culture. If you're going to run it that way as a dictator, you have to have everybody absolutely terrified all the time so no one takes a chance.
Wow.
How can you maintain that? How the fuck are they maintaining that?
If your family might get put in jail or killed, you'll do it.
I know, but I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it has to be at like a boiling point. Could you imagine?
Look at that.
These poor people.
Even the kids, they move you and they move.
Oh,
they move you. Like, you're designated where you live in North Korea, the neighborhood you live in. If your family was against or for the original founder of North Korea, Kim Jong-il's father, if they were in opposition to him, you live in a very shitty neighborhood. If they were allied to him, you're three generations later, you live in a good neighborhood.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Good stuff there. Nice guy.
It's just
he apparently was mad during the famine in the 90s that people were eating the dogs, were eating Korean dogs. It's like, they're our national, you know, the Jindo is like one of our national treasures, and these people are eating the dogs. He was all irritated. It's a good guy. Yeah. That's the worst country in the world. And it's always rated that way.
It's just so crazy to think that someone's able to pull that off in this day and age.
Well, he's got nuclear weapons. Thank you, Pakistan.
It's just, I just have a hard time believing that that can be maintained. But yet here it is. The fact that it's still here in 2015 is pretty nuts. This is like really late in the terms of civilization to have a full-on dictator like that. where you're like, look at those people crying again. Could you imagine any sort of a scene like that in America if a guy died who was the king?
God, look at that. Look at all that.
So these poor people are just faking crying.
Yeah.
Everybody terrified to not...
They all have handkerchiefs.
To stop crying too soon.
God.
Oh, my God.
It's madness. It's probably what a lot of history was about when you had a king, and he was absolute ruler. And if he was a sociopath, luckily, if you were lucky, you got a good king. Somebody who wasn't crazy.
God damn, dude. That is the nuttiest shit of all nutty shit. The fact that there's still a country of millions of people that live like that.
Yeah, I know.
God damn. That's terrifying. And whenever, you know, people talk about privilege, white privilege, black privilege, whatever kind of privilege you might have, heterosexual privilege, here's the biggest privilege. Not having to live like those folks.
Exactly.
And that's number one above all else.
But isn't that the reason, one of the good big reasons to at least read the newspaper or a little history or know what's going on in the world? Have some perspective any way you can get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that term white privilege, like people don't like that term. People get mad, which usually means there's some validity to it. If anybody says like white privilege and you see a white dude rolling his eyes, you might have a little racist in you, buddy. I might have a weird conversation with you and have to go, wait, what? No, Obama's not a Muslim. No. I had a conversation with a friend like that. In the middle of the conversation, he goes, Obama's the biggest Muslim in the country. I go, no, he's not. Like, what are you talking about? Why are you saying shit like that, man? There's no evidence that he's a Muslim at all.
No, none, zero.
Yeah.
By the way, his dad was Kenyan and Muslim, but he didn't know his dad very well. He grew up in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, but the dude's not living like some secret life where he's ready to blow up America from the inside.
Yeah.
And that's what these dumbasses think.
He doesn't have a callus on the middle of his head where he prays every day, which is...
Do they really get a callus?
You're supposed to. If you're very pious in Islam, you get a darker. The skin in that area where you touch your head to the floor is darker than the rest of your skin. That's when you know somebody's really, really religious.
So it's like the cauliflower ear of the Islam
world. Correct.
Wow, it's a badge of courage.
Pretty wild, right?
What happens if you're a pussy and you want like a little pillow, a little soft pillow? Do they get mad at you?
Don't the Orthodox Jews wear something like that when they pray?
I don't know. I do not know what their practice is.
Hmm. Well,
but they want to get. They're showing these guys with dark spots on their forehead. Oh my God!
Well,
Jeremy just pulled up all these photos of these guys with these super dark spots in their forehead.
Yeah, that's when you know that you got to just know that he's very religious.
Look at that old dude with the glasses down there. He's got like a hole in his head.
Well, that is Yaziri.
Scroll down a little bit, Jeremy.
That's Osama bin Laden's right hand man. That guy.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah,
right there.
He's a bad guy.
Look, he's got a hole in his head.
Yeah, Zawahiri. That's the Egyptian doctor who is. Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. He's still at large.
Can you make that photo larger? Is that possible?
Still at large. Bad guy.
Jesus Christ. Look, access forbidden.
Yeah, he's a doctor, too.
Jesus Christ. Look at his forehead, dude.
Yep.
That man, I never heard of this before. Yeah. This is insane. Brian Callen, you teach me something new every time we talk. You smart bitch.
Come on.
Look at that forehead, man. That's crazy. That dude has worn a hole in his head.
Yeah.
That's like, it looks, I mean, it's hard to tell because it's fairly low resolution, but whatever that is.
Not a good guy, by the way. He and Osama were good buddies. He's still alive. He's still out there. They don't know where he is.
Whoa.
The Egyptian doctor.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Very religious and very violent.
We live in a movie. We really do. We really live in a movie.
Yeah.
We live in a movie, and it's a weird one.
You mean just the fact that we're Americans, or in general?
The whole world is theater. I mean, it really is. I mean, obviously, it's real. But what I'm saying is, the way it's playing out, it's so goofy, it seems like a work of fiction.
Mm.
The North Korea thing seems like a work of fiction.
Yeah.
The uber-pious gentleman dressed like a genie who's worn a hole in his head from praying...
Yeah.
That guy is a character in a fucking movie. Oh, and by the way, they can't find him. He's out there.
And they can't find him.
He's out there. He's a doctor. He's evil. He's probably got millions of dollars, and they can't find him.
Yeah.
When does Batman come in? where's Batman?
It's true, right? It's also weird, like, people hatch plans, and they pull them off. Like, they just get together, and they go, listen, you guys, we're going to hijack planes and fly them into buildings. You know? People do.
Benghazi.
Yeah.
Anywhere. I mean, well, there's a bunch of different things, different events that have happened all over the world where people kept their mouth shut, plotted them, and executed them.
Dan Carlin in says this beautifully. He talks about, we always talk about, we live in the age of terrorism. He said, well, we live in the age of terrorism actually since 1914. And he tells a fascinating story. If you don't know the origins of World War One, it's very important because the World War One and World War Two are connected. World War Two is the continuation of World War One. And about 80 or 90 million people lost their lives because of those two wars. And it destroyed all of old Europe. Oh, and it changed the entire map of the world. Oh, and all of us live in its wake in a much deeper and more turbulent way than you can imagine. In fact, let me keep going. If you want to know about the Middle East, really, you got to study World War One. If you don't, no historian will take you seriously. And Dan Carlin says something fascinating. I don't know if you know the story. He said, World War One and the world you live in was changed by one man, and his name was Carvilo Princep, and he was a Serbian terrorist. And he found out that the Archduke Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, doesn't matter, was coming to town, and they had control of Serbia, and Serbia was looking for their independence. So they said, we're going to kill this guy. And he was in an open car with his mm-hmm. wife, and he was in a parade. And one of the Serbian terrorists came running out with a grenade or a bomb, threw it at the car, and it had a faulty thing, and it blew up under the other car, and six people were very badly injured. I think one person was killed. But guess what? Archduke Ferdinand, he survives. He goes, he makes a full account, they apologize to him, and remember, this was in Serbia. It was in Sarajevo, which was a sort of a colony, if you will, of the Serbo-Hungarian, of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Here was the next in line for the in charge of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, check this out. This is how crazy this is.
I know the story. I listened to the podcast.
Oh, you did? Okay. Maybe
go ahead and keep saying it if you want.
So
it's awesome.
It's just awesome because so now they say, well, we missed our assassination attempt. This guy, Carvilo Princep, who was part of this whole group, goes in for a sandwich. And as the Archduke Ferdinand said, let's get you out of here, he says, no, I want to go to the hospital and I want to check on all the survivors of this bombing. They said, okay, so they go down a road and the guy misses his turn. And he misses his turn and now he decides to back up. And as he's backing up, the car stalls and they got to kind of figure it out. And as the car stalls because he missed a turn, a guy named Carvilo Princep, part of this Serbian thing, comes walking out with a sandwich and he goes, what the fuck? There's the Archduke Ferdinand. He's just right in front of me. And he shoots him, and he shoots his wife. And that was because the driver missed a turn and was backing up, and Carvilo, by coincidence, just sees the Archduke and shoots him. And that pin, as Dan Carlin says, that created the hand grenade that was World War One and World War Two, was because a driver missed a turn, and because one terrorist, one 20-year-old guy, had a gun in his hand and said, that guy's a bad guy, and shot him. And our world has changed forever because of that strange missed turn. Yeah, and that's part of what's fascinating about history.
That's an amazing podcast. Which one is that?
It's called Countdown to Armageddon.
Yes.
And it is awesome. And I'm glad we get a chance to. Blueprint for Armageddon.
I'm so glad I had a chance to drive in a car with you. We had a long trip.
Oh,
and
man.
We could listen to Dan Carlin's The Mongol thing.
You opened a whole can of worms for me, man.
Dude, because I've been telling you how crazy that was, like, forever. I'm like, you just got to listen to this podcast. When people say that to me, though, it's hard to take them seriously. Oh, I just got to listen to another podcast.
Christ.
But if you just listen to Wrath of the Khans, you will be a changed human being.
100%.
You will understand what it was like to live in that time as best as anybody could ever describe it.
Yeah.
In a way that is so ultimately paralyzingly terrifying. Mm. 900 years later, whatever the fuck it is.
Oh, you mean because you're huddled in your church with your family and they're at the gates and they're bashing your gates down, you know they're going to come in and kill everybody?
That was like, what, 800 years ago?
Something along those lines? 700 years ago.
Jesus fucking Christ,
and you were going to get your head cut off. You were going to die by stabbing or cutting. It's going to suck.
And they were launching bodies. They would light bodies on fire and launch them with catapults to
and
land
fat,
on the thatch
human
roofs.
Fat.
Human fat burns better, apparently, mm-hmm. when you really light it on fire. It can catch things on fire better. Yeah. They were so fucking ruthless.
Well, I was thinking about how they lived. Like, you know, you and I, we go hunting. So we live outside and for 4 days or 3 days sometimes. And it's miserable. And we wake up and we're freezing and we're wet. And we're like, this blows. Can't wait to get back to civilization. But we do it because we love it. It brings us close to objective reality. We're like, I feel a little tougher, a little more manly. You know, the Mongols, I was thinking about how they lived. I was kind of trying to picture it. They're on a horse by the time they're three. They live in the Tartar... Yeah.
Just stop and think about that.
Yeah, let's just start there.
Three.
Throw the kid on a horse at
I have a four-year-old. She's not riding any fucking horses.
Fuck, no. Fuck, especially...
The horses are giant.
A wild horse in the Tartar steppes.
Christ.
Barely broken.
And they used to have like 20 of them per guy.
Yeah, they could whistle. They'd be like,
I had no idea.
And their horse would show up.
I never had heard that. I didn't know how that was one of the most terrifying things is like how well organized they were.
Well, because that's how they would hunt. So they would hunt on horseback. They were such trick riders. If you've been on a horse since you were three, you can do anything on a horse, right? You can shoot an arrow on a horse. You're just much faster. But here was where the clinical reality came in. I thought to myself, their lives were so violent to begin with. First of all, they lived. The staple was mare milk and blood from their horse, which they would mix. They'd mix the milk and the blood, and they would drink it. And I wonder what that does to you chemically, what that taste of
not
blood does.
Not good.
You. Probably not.
Fucking Christ. How many parasites did they have in their body by the time they were like 10 years old?
God knows, or none. And they would chase, because they would ferment the milk, and they would the way they would hunt animals, they would do the same with humans. They would sort of push them all into one area, then create an opening for them to run through, and then they'd be waiting with a party there. They were so... Fuck. Just daily existence was so physical and violent, you know?
And they had ultimate disdain for people that lived behind walls.
Yeah.
They lived in felt tents.
Yeah.
And that was like their whole thing. It's like the actual description of what they were calling Genghis Khan. Something about ruler of all who dwell in the felt tents.
Something crazy like that.
Dude, they would show up in town and they would say, look, I guess you guys weren't aware that you owe Genghis Khan money.
Yeah.
So, or Genghis, they like to say Genghis. It was Genghis when John Wayne did it. I grew up with Genghis.
I'm calling him Genghis, dude. I swear to God, it's the only thing with Dan Carlin. I was like,
Genghis.
Dude, call it Genghis.
Genghis Khan.
His real name is Temuchin.
But Dan Carlin, what he does so good is make it utterly fascinating. He's such an expert narrator.
He's a storyteller.
He's an expert. Yeah. I mean, like a real master at it.
Yeah.
So when he's telling you these stories, it's not just really cool information, which it most absolutely is, but it's the way he's written it all and put it together and worded it. It's just fucking brilliant.
Yeah. He lives in Portland.
It's brilliant.
Right?
Don't give out his fucking address. Sorry. What if the Mongols come?
You're right.
Shit, man.
I'm just going to be in Portland a little bit. I want
to
invite him.
What are you trying to do to him, man? Getting weird.
Dan, if you're listening to this, come to my show in Portland.
He's a great guy. You'll love
tweet
to hang out with him. He's a super cool guy. Real fun. I've had him on the podcast a few times.
Yeah, I'd love to meet him.
He's doing a goddamn national service with that thing.
100%.
World service, I should say. I shouldn't 100%. Say national, because it's on the internet.
Could not agree more.
It's so much more entertaining than any other history thing I've ever witnessed, and watched, listened to.
I mean, I've spent enough time over the past 20 years at least listening to different kinds of, like, the turning points in European history and, you know, from the teaching company. Really good professors. Yeah. Nothing compares to that guy. Nothing.
Well, there's so many good podcasts right now, just like this. You know, I was talking with someone yesterday about how many good TV shows there are today as opposed to, like, when we were kids.
Yeah.
You know, like, when we were kids, like, what was a really good show on TV?
MASH.
I guess MASH was a really good
sitcom.
Mary
Tyler Moore.
What was, like, a really good drama? Was there any...
Oh, Hill Street Blues.
Hill Street Blues.
That was great. But that's the only one I can think of offhand.
But Hill Street Blues is later. That was, like, wasn't that...
It was 80s, 85.
Was it really?
Actually, it was 81.
Why do I have that all fucked up in my head? Oh, I think I have it fucked up with NYPD Blue. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Well, what else? What was another good drama? I can't think of a good drama right now.
But compare that to what's available today. Mm. Compare that to Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, House of Cards, Homeland. I mean, Jesus Christ.
It's nuts.
It's nuts.
Can't
it's
even keep
an
up.
Assault of wizard shows. They're so goddamn good. Yeah. And you got to be good because they have those HBO shows now. Those HBO shows took everything to a totally different level.
Yeah.
When they put out The Sopranos, the whole
changed
game
everything.
Changed.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're like, Jesus, this is better than a movie. Well, this is a movie that's forever.
Because they made a character. It used to be the rule was the character has to be somebody you like who you want to bring in your living room every week. That was the rule. And when you went to pitch a show and your character wasn't quote-unquote likable, people were like, nah, it's not going to work. Along comes Tony Soprano, huge adulterer, murderer.
Kills his friends.
Orders the assassination of his friend. And tells his son to do his homework in the same breath. Talk about a dichotomy. And of course, as human beings, we're like, well, that's real life. That's how I feel sometimes.
He was the greatest mob character in the history 100%. Of mob characters. Over the top, down the hill, through the valley, up the mountain, through the ocean. Everyone else can suck his dick.
Yeah.
All of them. They all can suck his dick.
Well, we were talking
He's
about the best,
greatest of all time.
I think me and Shab and a couple other people were talking about the best overall character on TV ever.
Tony Soprano. My,
yeah, I think it's got to be
Tony Soprano.
Either that or Walter White.
Walter White's a good bet,
yeah.
too.
I was torn between the two, and I think I ultimately went with Walter. But I might say now, because of peer pressure, Tony Soprano.
Yeah. You know, there's been some goddamn good ones. There's like... But that... His character had... We had so much time to get to know him.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just what was so different, was that it was... wasn't like television style, like show making.
Yeah.
It was movie making.
Right.
But it was a new thing because it was really complex and you could do it over a long time. You could have a season and you're mm-hmm. going, you know, you're telling a story over months and months
yeah.
and you're getting people addicted. It's a completely different experience.
Yeah.
And you realize, like, at a certain level, like, that show changed everything. That show changed everything. It was just so next level.
Yeah.
I never give a fuck about mob shows.
Yeah. Because
was there even
way,
one before that?
In a way, it wasn't even a mob show. In a way, it was a guy running two families, a crime family and his own family. That was the idea. So, you know, and so you were looking at a human being, and what I think they did an amazing job was, as evil as he was, they were putting him in impossible situations. You couldn't run that fucking crime family without being a complete motherfucker. Yet...
Yeah.
He had to run his own family, make his marriage work, and all that shit. I think a lot of people identified with how impossible life is that way.
Yeah.
It's an extreme example, but, you know.
It is, really. It's like, we could almost, if you were born that guy and that guy's family and that guy's life and that guy's neighborhood with that guy's experiences, you would be in the exact same situation as he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
A chain of events from the time you were shat out of your mother's vajayjay.
That's right.
Has led you to where you're at. Just like looking at those North Korean people, man. Should they pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Like, what should they do?
Yeah.
Like, to anyone to say that,
suffer.
Hey, you know what? Hey, everybody's got it hard. My friend Mike, he was born in Africa, but he said, I want to be American. So he got in a car, he drove to the airport, he bought it. No, you know those guys? Like, if they wanted to, they could do it. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what the fuck you said, you anecdotal asshole?
Yeah.
You tell one shitty story about some supposed friend that probably doesn't even exist,
well,
that was born in the steppe.
I remember the argument with Saddam Hussein was like, if you make the sanctions strong enough, his people will get so miserable that they'll overthrow the government.
Oh, Christ.
Oh, yeah? You try overthrowing that guy when he kills your whole family.
Yeah, the ruthlessness that these people operate under. Like, if you live in America and you have an experienced war and you start talking about stuff like that, like, stop.
You got
no idea. You're talking crazy.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember there was a time during the debates, like John McCain, I think any time you've got Sarah Palin as your fucking running mate, you're hamstrung,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's basically over. Because no one rational is going to say yes to that.
Right.
Like, you've got someone of really clearly marginal intelligence.
Yeah.
It's very marginal, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the way she communicates, she's obviously not very bright.
She's certainly very, myopic in her experience and her perspective.
Well, she's got that down-home folksy thing going on, but it seems
which is
very poorly thought out.
Yeah.
Like, there are people that are down-home and folksy. When you talk to them, their way of communicating, you could still get through that conversation. Like, well, this is an intelligent, nuanced person
mm-hmm.
with a lot of depth to what they're saying. This is just the way they talk,
mm-hmm.
you know? Maybe they're from Wisconsin. Maybe it's like Doug Durant, our friend Doug.
Yeah.
From Wisconsin, very much.
Very smart guy. And
brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant guy.
Yeah.
If you underestimated him because he's a farmer in Wisconsin,
you'd be in for a surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that someone has to fit into any particular, you know, style of communication.
Right.
Just to be recognized.
Well, I got a kick. We were in Napa, and we were talking about, what was the wine? It was Camus, which is a high-end mm-hmm. wine, like $200 a bottle. And she was saying that the guy who makes the wine, I mean, when you buy a Camus wine in a restaurant, please be ready to spend, if it's special select, $325. And you'd think, this is a genius winemaker. And she was like, he's a farmer. At heart, he's a farmer. He grows good grapes, and then kind of does the thing that he was told. But at the end of the day, Wagner's a farmer. And you know, but you would understand underestimate him. If you saw him in his overalls, and you'd be like, well, that guy's one of the best winemakers in the world, you know?
Well, those folks that we were talking to up in Napa, the Rinella's friends' friends,
yeah.
They were all farmers. They were grape farmers.
Yep.
They were the nicest people.
They really were. How about that
food?
They
were so cool. The food was delicious. As soon as I saw that guy, and I saw that he was cooking tri-tips, I'm like, this motherfucker, I guarantee you could cook the shit out of a tri-tip.
I remember you said
that. Old California dudes, old rancher California
cowboy
dudes.
Hat.
They know how to cook those tri-tips, because a tri-tip is a very peculiar type of meat. It's very lean, and you can't overcook it. You got to cook it the right amount. There's not a lot of fat on it.
Right.
But if you know how to nail it, and for whatever reason, California ranchers, they'd specialize. They had like a special grill for it.
Mm.
I think it's called a Santa Maria grill, and it cranks. And as you're cranking, you like raise or lower it above the heat, and you want to make it. It's like you have to. This is back. They learned how to do this shit before they had thermometers. It was just how the fork would go into it. They could figure out like how done it was just by how the fork felt, how it slid into it. So I saw that dude, and I saw he was cooking tri-tips. I'm like, oh, we're eating here, dude. Because we were thinking about going to a restaurant.
Restaurants in the world, and we actually forewent them because it was so goddamn good.
Well, that guy was cool as fuck when we started talking to him. Damn it. Do you remember his name?
No.
I want to say Mike.
I know his son is a model for...
Was it Rick or Mike?
His son, who was a nice guy, was there, is a model. I forgot to give him shit for it, but his son was a model for romance novels.
Vampire romance ones. A lot of vampire ones.
Ah, you know you've made it when you're a model for vampire romance novels.
Damn it, I forgot his name too, but he was cool.
Yeah.
Very, very friendly guy.
Yeah.
But he's just a devastatingly handsome guy.
I interrupted you with my tangential story about that because you reminded me of it. And you were making a larger point.
What was I saying?
Fuck.
Who cares?
Jamie?
Whatever it was, it couldn't be that important.
Exactly. Keep it rolling. Keep it rolling here.
I don't even remember at all.
Hey, man, we went turkey hunting, you guys.
Look at this quote from the Denver police. The Denver police, they put out a tweet. No, that's not what it was, Jamie. There was one. It was more hilarious. Scroll down a little bit. It was the 420 tweet. Does it,
There it is.
No. They had like rolling. Put it. It's on my Twitter, dude. Okay. Just go to my Twitter and you'll find it. But it's actually kind of hilarious. I retweeted it. I think
it's a good picture of you there.
That's some sexy as fuck. Look at that. In Denver, I said even the police are high on 420. Look at this. This is the police. We see you rolling, but we ain't hating. Ha ha. Seriously though. Hashtag Denver. Please remember to hashtag consume responsibly this 420 weekend.
Good for
That's
them.
The police department.
I like the police department in Denver.
They have little music things there. What are those emojis?
Yep.
Little music emojis.
Good for them. Good for them. I love it.
Is that the nicest police department of all time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might be. See, ladies and gentlemen, this is what happens when you let a state get stoned. This is what happens. This is exactly what I've been telling you forever, and it's in action right now. This is the police are nicer.
First it was fluoride in their water and nobody was getting cavities, and now it's weed. Way to go, Colorado.
Is fluoride in the water good, dude? Is that real?
Well,
I
think in the 50s what they found was there are certain communities in Colorado that were not getting cavities. I think it's in Colorado. And they couldn't figure out why. Why weren't the kids getting cavities? And they found there was a high level of fluoride in the water.
Naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does happen, right? Like if you have, there's some waters that have higher levels of fluoride, like natural fluoride.
Yeah.
And like apparently there's... That's one of the things that's supposed to be not good when you drink distilled water.
Right.
They say don't. Yeah, because you want all those minerals and all that other jazz that's in water.
Very much so. I think, and I believe if you use distilled water on a plant, a lot of times the plant dies. That's what I was told from a farmer.
But some people think that fluoride ultimately is not good for your body. Is there any science that goes with that? Because people love to quote, they always say this one thing, hey man, it calcifies your pineal gland. And I'm like, have you done any lab biopsies?
Yeah. We have a pretty good big control group, like the entire population of the United States over the past 50 years. I don't see a lot of people with calcified pineal glands.
I don't know if that's even a real thing,
first of all. I don't know.
Is it possible?
Isn't it your third eye? Isn't the pineal gland?
Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Well, mine always feels all stiff. I can't see out of it, I'll tell you that much.
And then there's this other one that they say, that maybe Snopes this, Jamie. They say, do you know that fluoride in the water was pioneered by the Nazis for mind control? Dude.
Well,
did you know that, man? So think about that. Think about that, man. I drink rainwater.
I will think about it because you haven't thought about it. So
listen, dude, you don't even know. I'm online.
When was the last time you read a book besides Twilight?
Infowars.com.
I knew it.
Manual of Life.
Infowars.com.
read a book besides Twilight. If you're a guy and you're reading Twilight,
lose my number. Come out of the closet.
Come out of the closet. You can be like what you like. It's all right. Like what you like, man.
I was at the Chateau Marmont, and that guy sat at the table.
What guy?
Me and my buddy Frank Grillo were the guy, the main vampire, the heartthrob.
Oh, the fucking guy from Twilight?
Uh-huh.
Robert Pattinson?
Yes.
Pattinson?
Yes, and he sat at my table, and I stared at him. I didn't say hi. He was very nice. And he got up, and he's like, nice to meet everybody. And I was like, see you later. That's my story about him.
That's
got
an
nothing.
Amazing story.
Thank you, buddy.
Dude, you should write that down.
I met him.
There's a guy named John Stewart that I used to work with on Fear Factor. The greatest, hilarious dude. Really? Just a guy who'd been in show business forever, and he was a straight total pro. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it can't get any better than this. He's just one of those guys.
Love
like
those guys.
He would move the contestants through. Everybody was smiling when they talked to him. Just one of those motherfuckers. He's Kristen Stewart's dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, of course. He was raised by a wild man. He's a cool motherfucker.
Yeah.
He's the coolest. Long hair, scraggly hair.
That's great. You know, his daughter's a movie
old
star.
Old school dude, man. He's been around forever. Just a super sweet guy,
She probably grew up around sets, acting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably. But back then, like, she did a couple movies, and I was like, dude, why are you letting your daughter do that? Doesn't it freak you out that she's, like, going to get famous at a young age? And she wasn't worried about it.
Huh.
And then obviously, she became this giant fucking movie star. Yeah. So I'm like, dude, lucky you didn't listen to me.
Yeah, get her out of acting.
I was telling you to pull your daughter
out.
She
could be selling insurance right now.
The gigantic fucking movie star. So don't listen to me ever. How about that? If I give you advice. But who knows, man? Truth about fluoride doesn't include the Nazi myth. Okay, so the Nazi is a myth. Yeah. History shows, actually, that in Nazi Germany, one of the first things they did was add fluoride to the water in the ghettos where the Jews stayed. Matt Leffler of Cleveland told the county commissioner Tuesday before. Well, what does it say here? Well, if he's saying, okay, what is this? Is not saying whether it's real or not real or who knows. This is just a story on it. We should figure out, like, what is the actual truth? Where does the story come from? Here it goes. Where does the story come
There's
from?
There's no teeth to this claim.
Yeah. I can almost guarantee you that it is indeed an urban myth, said Andy Hollinger, who handles the media relations at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Well, okay. Okay. It seems like it's not real then, right? Or it could be. It wasn't about Nazis fluoridating water. It was communists. What? Okay. So it seems like more than likely it was an urban myth. Now, what about, this is the thing, Jamie, Google this. Fluoride calcifies the pineal gland, because I just want
to... Let's get to the bottom of this.
Get to the bottom of this nonsense.
Fluoride shit.
How many studies have been done on the pineal gland? What happens if, what's fluoride doing in there?
When are they going to clone hair? That's what I want to know, ladies and gentlemen.
You can get hairier. Fluoride deposition aged human pineal gland. So is it saying the purpose was to discover? Scroll down. Sorry. Purpose was to discover whether fluoride accumulates in the aged human pineal gland. The aims were to determine AF concentrations of the pineal gland, wet, whatever that means, corresponding muscle, wet and bone, ash, B calcium concentration of the pineal muscle and bone were dissected from 11 aged cadavers. Okay, what is it saying? Too much reading.
I'll take a calcified pineal gland than holes in my teeth. Holes in my teeth suck.
Here it goes, right here. Fluoride does not accumulate in the brain. Well, wait a minute. Okay, so it's not. So you would really do that, though? You would take calcium in your pineal gland? I mean, it's saying it's not real. But what if it was real?
Yeah.
You would take that over holes in your teeth?
That's
really?
Right. Whoa. I don't want holes in my teeth. I give
but what
a fuck
about
my...
dentists? Dentists
I don't use
awesome.
My pineal gland.
Do
I?
Yeah, you do.
I do?
Makes melatonin.
Oh, shit.
They believe now that it makes dimethyltryptamine, that really heavy-duty psychedelic.
Oh.
It makes a bunch of different things.
Shit. Well, I'll take melatonin pills and have good teeth.
You know what it looks like? The weird thing about the pineal gland. Have you ever seen the... Look up Egyptian image pineal gland. The actual, like, side view of the pineal gland.
I didn't even know it was actually real. I always thought it was, like, the third eye. And it was
it's a real... That's what's really fucked up. Look what it looks like. It looks like that thing.
Hmm.
A lot. That Egyptian symbol.
Oh, wow.
A lot. Yeah. Like, if you look at the actual structure of the pineal gland and that eye, what is that eye supposed to represent? Does anyone know? Probably someone super smart is watching you, bitch. That's what it looks like to me. I mean, it's super, super similar in appearance.
Yeah.
What the pineal gland looks like and what that thing looks like if it's dissected. And,
I'm sure the Egyptians did their share of cutting brains up. And
I mean, you look at that thing nestled.
So that's
in
where
there.
The pineal gland is, way inside the brain. I thought it was right.
It's right in
your forehead.
No, it's like look where your eyeballs are, right?
Yeah.
And then it's like literally like right here and back, like right where your brain stuff is.
Okay.
Like, right in there. Apparently, they think that this uncertain, like lower animals, like snakes, I think, or reptiles, that thing actually has a retina and a lens.
I don't see where it says pineal gland on this thing.
I think that's back up there, Jamie. That's what the gland is. I mean, that's where it is.
Let's it looks back, like that's back the thalamus.
See no, see, where does it show it? Does it have a button?
I think that's the thalamus, buddy. At least according to that.
Pineal gland, part one, right there. See? The pineal gland on the right, and there, the eye.
Okay.
That's what they're saying here. Neither of us know what the fucking pineal gland looks like.
Oh, there it is. The pineal gland looks like it's at the base.
How freaky is that?
I don't know. It's nuts.
All of the knowledge that your brain is making all these weird chemicals all the time and keeping them in balance is super important. And you can do it with like exercise, and you can do it with like having positive thinking, getting outside in the sun. And
it's also, what is the brain? That's what it's what really is it?
Yeah. What really is it?
You know, that's what kind of,
it's some sort
blows
of a,
my mind.
Some sort of a, as it's functioning, you know, as it's all lit up, right? It's some sort of a portal to everything in the universe. And that's really what the brain is. And eventually that thing will get to a point where it's capable of communicating with anybody within any reasonable distance instantaneously. So as this brain continues to get stronger, accumulate more information, accumulate more technological breakthroughs that allow it to do more things and manipulate matter more, as long as it stays alive, as long as the human organism stays alive, you've thought of it as a giant super thing.
Yeah.
It's something that, if you're looking at the, in terms of like the creation of the earth, right? The earth is billions of years old. It took a long fucking time to go from the first version of the earth, all the rocks and the lava and the water and shit, to what we have today. It takes a long ass time. Well, I think the human organism takes a long ass time to become what it really is. And what it really is like the universe figured out how to build something that can make a universe.
Well, I was going to say that the human brain is going to get to a point where it's able to replicate itself and then improve on itself.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to download other people's brains, and you'll be able to send your download to other people's brains, and you'll have an experience of what it's like to be that person.
And there's some people that resist this because they say, look, we already right now don't know nearly enough about the biological functions of the human body. We already right now don't know. I absolutely understand that, and I agree that they're right. I you know, I'm not disputing that at all. What I am saying, though, is it might not even matter. They might be able to come up with technology that completely circumvents all the biological bullshit that we have to deal with as far as like processing proteins and phytonutrients and all that horse shit. We could possibly bypass that one day.
Like by meshing with machines?
Yes,
you mean?
Yeah. I think it's going to happen. I really do.
I know you had Aubrey de Grey on your podcast. I had him on mine.
I'm having him on again.
Oh.
I had him on my show, but I'm having him on the podcast real soon.
Wow. Yeah, because I was talking, and he was talking about there are seven different, I guess, a cell, there are seven different ways a cell degenerates, and they're working on figuring out ways to stop that degeneration. It's a mechanical issue at this point, but they're isolating how a cell breaks down, why it does, and they're going to try to figure out a way to stop it. But, you know, I said nanotechnology and stuff, there's a chance that all your work could be circumnavigated by just that inexorable rise toward, you know, just kind of pushing us way beyond our biology with machines. And he was like, yeah, maybe, you know.
I just think if you look at it in terms of the long haul, let's just assume that people are able to stay alive and not blow each other up or not get hit by a meteor for the long haul. Let's give us 100 years. Do you have any idea how
goddamn crazy technology is going to be in 100 years. So anybody like that's poo-pooing us, we don't have the capabilities. Don't you think that that's what they said back when they lived in caves?
Yeah.
How we got to block that hole. We can't do it. We don't know how.
Yeah.
They had to figure out how to make a fucking door, okay? Somebody had to figure out how to make a door to a cave. Somebody had to figure out fire. Somebody had to figure out stone tools. And then we learn from them. It all keeps steamrolling. And apparently, the brain is evolving as well. The brain is evolving in the way that it interfaces with computers, the way we process information. It's all different. Our way of, like, the allocation of resources mentally is very different now than it was before. You could just ask Google a question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is some weird shit's going to happen to the very brain itself if we start adding things to it, if we start putting in little transmitters or little things, little ways to wirelessly interface with each other. You know, you and I have talked about this, that experiment that they did where they sent a word, they sent a couple words from one person to the other person through the internet, and they received the word. They were blindfolded. They take all these steps to make sure that the way they're receiving it was only brain to brain. Like, dude, we're getting, like, these are the baby steps of some really crazy shit.
Yeah.
And if we could just stay alive, if you could stay alive for like 100 years, the world will be unrecognizable.
Well, they say that's the case in 40 or 50. Ray Kurzweil says in 40 or 50 years, it's going to be...
He might be right.
Yeah, because it's moving so exponentially. And the minute machines start replicating themselves or building better machines,
yeah,
it comes with a very dark side, but also comes from a very promising side.
Biologists reject it. Biologists reject it.
That
a
makes
lot
sense,
of
though.
Them do. But a lot of them do because they think that they don't know enough about the human mind to even come close to saying that we could replicate it or download consciousness into a computer. And that seems to be the truth. But what I think is it's going to be the case of technology reaching a level of capability that we can't even fathom. We can't fathom it. It's too far away from our little pea brains right now. Yeah. There could be a kind of an interface that we can't even imagine.
I think that if you can imagine it, I think that the human imagination exists because that is a window into what is actually possible. In other words, you know, I think that if you can imagine it, it's going to be a matter of time before it actually becomes something you can measure and see with your eye, your ear, or an instrument. I think it's going to be something you can actually touch. I think anything that, like you're talking about, downloading the human brain, communicating the way we communicate with radio waves, the way we texting each other with our brains, I don't think that's magic. I don't think it's far-fetched. I think if you look at the way science seems to be developing, it's a matter of when, not if.
It's so weird. If you think about what a human being is, if you think about, like, I've been watching a lot of nature documentaries lately, man. I've gone through this one of these weird stages where I just started watching documentaries on, you know, various animals.
Yeah.
And just the cruelty of the environment that they live in, the cannibalism and the attacking each other. And just
life eats life.
Oh, it's fucking chaos, man. We watched this documentary on baboons. These baboons fucking each other up, and you're like, Jesus Christ, trying to protect their babies. And the baboon should, the show should have been called Dead Baby Baboon, because they showed like 10 fucking dead baby baboons.
This scientist on TED Talk was talking about how humans are not the only animals that just kill each other because the animals kill out of dominance or food and stuff. No. He said, let me tell you something. This baboon showed up. He studies baboons. Baboon shows up in this whole group, and he's kind of an asshole. He's just loud. He's just not being respectful to the other males. He's just running around, like, kind of trying to fuck the women without going through the necessary baboon steps you got to. And he's just loud and being a pain in the ass. Well, the next morning, he goes, I knew this baboon was going to get it. I just didn't know how. Next morning, he shows the picture. All they find is the baboon's face, basically tore him asunder, threw him in every direction, and just his perfect face going, ah, like that, just a silent scream was left on the ground.
Whoa.
He said, that's what they do.
Cut his face off. With what, their teeth?
Yeah, they just bit his head off. They bit his head away from his face, basically. Yeah, they got some big teeth.
They do. They have ferocious-looking teeth, man. They're weird. They're like a dog fucked a monkey.
Yeah.
That's what it's
exactly
like.
Exactly right.
It's really what it's like. It doesn't look like any other animal. It's such a weird dog-monkey combination.
Shitty
like,
pet.
A shitty pet, you think? If a baboon was in a movie, like if they didn't exist, but they were in like Lord of the Rings, they would be a terrifying animal. Like an animal that lived in the forest that was thinking about, like, stealing your baby.
Oh.
You know?
Oh.
They eat human babies, man.
Well,
so will chimps, too, by the way.
We threw a birthday party for one of my kids, and they brought a baboon.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, the big baboon. Yeah, we're just not going to pet her. She was very submissive. She would fall to the ground and let you pick bugs from her back. That's how they show submission.
Right.
But nervous. She was nervous.
No.
She had big teeth, and she was large.
Oh,
and I was
no.
like, let's keep about 10 yards back.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Well, that's not fair. That animal shouldn't be there. It's not fair to the animal.
I agree.
You're putting the animal without even understanding its language. You're putting it in this incredible stressful situation where it's around kids.
Yeah.
Look at the fucking teeth on that thing.
That's a male.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
They're monsters.
Yeah.
Just monsters. Look at the teeth. It's like a werewolf.
It is.
What an insanely crazy looking animal.
God, wow.
Like, if that was in a movie and that was chasing after Bilbo Baggins, you would totally buy it.
You better
You'd be
run.
Like, oh my God, that's a werewolf. How is that not a werewolf? I mean, look at the fucking teeth on that thing. Those are giant teeth, man.
Yeah.
Those fangs are so disproportionately large.
I think, Do the females have teeth like that? Probably. Damn, look at that thing.
Jesus Christ.
Look at that coloring.
Oh my God. Dude, blow that picture up. Look at the fucking face on that thing.
Yeah, but look at the female genitalia in the other picture.
Not something I'm looking at. Look at that.
Yeah, that's just retarded.
What a face, too.
Man.
Like, this is real. Like, okay, if human beings didn't exist, if we just didn't exist at all on Earth, this fucking thing would be out there just like it is now.
Mm.
If we never existed.
Yeah.
If we never figured out houses, we died off a long fucking time ago. That thing would be out there just like that.
Yeah.
That thing would be out there a million years from now, just like that. Look at that fucking monster. I mean, we made it to 2015 with cell phones.
Yeah.
And jet airplanes and microwave ovens and TVs and laptops. And that fucking primate that came up with us, this fucker didn't make it out of the neighborhood.
That's what they always say is the fundamental difference between human beings and animals, even though we're an animal. We're the only animal with potential. We're the only animal that continues to evolve.
We evolve within our own lives.
Yeah.
We can see, and if you're really observant of yourself and correcting of yourself, you'll continually evolve.
Yeah.
You're going to be smarter and better.
10 generations in that baboon, they're all going to be the same way.
That's interesting that you said that, because I keep saying Radiolab, but there was another podcast they did about instincts and how you could change the entire behavior of a tribe of baboons if they got rid of this one alpha male that was like fucking everybody up.
Really?
Yeah, they got
a
rid
dictator.
Of one. Yeah, they got rid of one alpha male that was fucking everybody up, and then something happened. I forget what the actual event was that caused them to be submissive to each other and grooming each other, and then they just kind of kept up with it, and then they came back years later expecting to see the same sort of violent behavior that they'd witnessed before. But no, they had developed this like peaceful baboon tribe.
Because there was no threat.
Well, it was a way lesser threat. They're still fucking baboons.
Yeah.
But apparently the way they dealt with each other was way more relaxed. Like, and that was really confusing to these biologists who observed it. It was very unexpected, I should say. Shouldn't say confusing. I mean, it was a welcome discovery, I'm sure. You're realizing, like, wow, how much of behavior, okay, like we're talking about North Korea and we're talking about America in 2015. Look at the difference between the way the cultures are allowed to communicate and express themselves. Just by this podcast, you could see the difference between someone who lives in a crazy, but this crazy dictatorship that they're living in is happening in the same timeline.
Yeah.
It's happening right now.
Well, it goes back to also when you first started this podcast about talking about most people are great and there's a couple of assholes. It takes only a couple of assholes in charge to change the character mm-hmm. of an entire society too, and make people behave in a very crazy way. Those baboons changed when you took away the alpha. I wonder if North Koreans would be crying for 3 hours straight if they didn't have a fucking alpha male running their tribe who was that much of a fucking monster. Obviously not.
I wish I could remember the exact specifics of what caused them to chill out. I didn't remember. Too much information in my head. I'm having a real problem with that lately. I gotta regulate the amount of information that's going in my head and then go over it with a fine-tooth comb. Yeah. I feel like I'm taking in all day way too much data.
I feel that way too. Like I forget. I can't really remember names and specifics. I have to start talking in general terms. Because I'm afraid I'll make a mistake.
I'm talking really about individual stories and individual subjects of news, especially because I feel like if you got online every day and started scouring the news and looking for interesting things and seeing the latest video, did you see the silverback gorilla that slammed into the cage at the zoo?
No.
Oh, ready? Tighten up your belt.
My favorite.
Okay, there's a little kid that starts doing some chest thumps.
No.
Yes, she does. And the silverback ain't hearing it. Watch this. This is fucking crazy, dude. So you see the little kid? You can see her in the corner. She's pounding her hands on her chest. Look at this.
Oh, man.
Why is our... We never fixed that.
Damn.
The shitty video quality thing, those little things we bought didn't fix it.
Look at Coco the Gorilla with Robin Williams.
We still have that really super shaky video for some reason. Yeah, Coco the Gorilla. I can't believe he let that thing touch him.
They're a lot less dangerous than a... They say gorillas have their own personality, so some can be really mean and some can be really sweet.
I'm sure she was super sweet, but if she wanted to just pull your dick off and stuff it through your eyeball, she could anytime she wanted to.
I think Coco might be a guy, isn't it?
Is it? Why do I think it's a girl?
Look at how thick.
Oh, wow. See, he just pulls him down to him.
Dude, look at that.
Oh, my God. Can you go full screen on that?
Oh,
or is that when it screws up?
I can get a little bigger.
Okay. Look at Robin Williams. He's a good man.
Oh, my God. Well, that's like an alien, dude. You know?
Oh, look at that.
Wow, it kisses his hand. Holy shit. This
What an amazing time.
This is a bizarre video. I guess I wouldn't be so nervous. That thing looks really peaceful.
Look at him.
Wow, it took his glasses and put his glasses on. Whoa. See, that's when it gets really weird. And you go, what are we dealing with here? This is like a life form that speaks... some sort of a sign language with human beings, so it understands what you're saying. It just can't vocalize the noises that we want it to in order to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, that is a crazy animal right there. If that thing didn't exist, fuck Bigfoot. I'll just say it right now. Fuck Bigfoot and his dirty, crusty ass. Bigfoot's not nearly as cool as a goddamn gorilla.
Look, he's saying, tickle me. He wants you. You're going to tickle a gorilla.
Isn't that nuts? He signs tickle.
I just
want to
see how much stronger that thing is than me.
Oh, what are you talking about? You can't even fathom it.
Just a different level.
It's not even the same. It's just not fair. It's like, how much stronger are you than a flower?
Well, how about just Brendan, who grabbed me around the waist the other day, and he was like, yesterday I was trying to get out. First of all, I tried to shoot a single leg on him.
Look at that. No, keep it going. Look at this. This is so crazy. It's just looking at that body.
Look at him laughing.
It's so nuts. They're laughing and tickling each other. Well, great pet. You're hilarious.
I want one so bad.
Keep a gorilla in your house until he decides that he wants to eat your food right now.
Yeah, well.
They actually are strict vegetarians, which people find shocking.
Yeah, they are.
And people are like, hey, man.
Not the chimpanzee.
This is totally evidence that you can eat an all-plant diet and you can be immensely massive and muscular. Or it's evidence that gorillas are different than people.
Well, they always say, well, bulls are so strong and they're total vegetarians. All right, go eat grass and then run a mile. See how you feel.
Yeah, good luck with that.
You have four stomachs? Whatever the fuck it is?
We're different, man. That's a gorilla. It's different than a person. It needs only broccoli.
Coco checks his ID.
That is hilarious. Signs tickles. I went to the Santa Barbara Zoo like maybe 6 months ago or so. And they have gorillas there, and you just get like right up next to them in the glass, and you look in and you see them walking around, and they're essentially just a few yards from you, just right there walking around.
Yeah,
and it's kind of fucked up.
You mean in San Diego?
Santa Barbara.
Yeah,
it's kind of fucked up because you really shouldn't be able to just look at a gorilla. Because if you just look at them in real life, they run at you. They make them. You ever seen the bluff charge that they make? That is. Pull a video of that.
Terrifying.
Gorilla makes silverback makes bluff charge. Do we figure out why this is so
crack the safety
shitty?
Glass.
After here he goes. Look at this. Boom.
Damn.
Do you have any idea how fucking strong he must be?
Oh. So
thick. And that was just because she was pounding her chest. Isn't that nuts? Man gets charged by what does that say? Gorilla? The second one down?
Yeah.
Is that the one I think that's the one I've seen.
Largest silverback, 500 pounds.
Try that one. Bluff charge. Ooh. 500 pound silverback. Look at the belly on that
dude,
thing.
Dude, you got a belly. That's parasites, bro.
Is that what that is?
I don't know, but that's a crazy belly. I'm disgusted and ashamed.
Do you think that gorilla cares about his gut?
I don't think so.
Freak him out? Is that a girl you think or a guy?
I think it's a guy.
That looked very girl-like for some reason. Like maybe she was pregnant.
Oh, maybe she was.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably
why. There's the silverback.
That's probably why the silverback's going to bum rush the show.
There's the silverback.
Can you imagine these assholes are actually, and I say assholes with all due affection and admiration, but these dudes are in the middle of the fucking jungle just walking around with cameras in front of wild gorillas.
Yeah, not to mention there are a bunch of really bad people in the Rwandan jungles.
Yeah.
I think Joseph Kony hangs out there sometimes.
Yeah.
And, and his Hutu militias.
What a freaky animal a gorilla is.
Yeah.
Super intelligent thing. It's enormous.
Possibly strong. And just possibly strong.
Eats vegetation. And is so strong, it could just rip you apart with its hands. And that's how it gets by. It gets by not by killing everything around it. It gets by being able to kill so many things that everybody just goes, fuck that.
Yeah.
That's why they nest on the ground.
It's unbelievable.
Gorillas, they could. If a gorilla wanted to pull himself up a tree, it would be pretty fucking easy.
Yeah.
But they don't nest in trees. And part of it, I'm sure, that's a pregnant gorilla,
She's pregnant.
Part of it, because she looks like a female. She looks, because I'm a biologist. I don't know if you know. she just looks less horrifically strong than the male is.
Yeah, yeah.
She's more like soft and fuzzy.
But didn't they find out recently they used tools?
They definitely will dig with sticks.
Yeah.
They'll dig to get roots and shit. Well, they're all vegetation. That's what they eat. They're all about vegetation. I'm sure that they have probably figured out some sort of tool to do something. I mean, it just makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're building the wheel or, constructing houses.
That thing is still food to a bear.
Look at the size of that thing.
Grizzly bear.
Look at the size of that thing. I don't know about all that.
Oh, it's 500 pounds. How much does a grizzly weigh?
A lot more.
Yeah.
A lot more. But it's a different kind of weight.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, a grizzly bear is a ridiculously strong animal, but a fucking big 500-600 pound gorilla, he might fuck a grizzly bear up. He might smack a grizzly bear in his head. Grizzly bear might be stupid to tangle with this thing.
Hard to hurt, he looks like. Look at his head.
Well, the grizzly bears are impossible to hurt. Have you ever seen them bite each other?
Yeah.
It's insane.
So what's the bear going to do? Unless he knows jiu-jitsu, the gorilla's got to get behind him and choke him
out.
What's
the gorilla going to do? The gorilla's going to just smack him in the head. Just pound him, bite him, throw him. Maybe freak the fucking bear out into thinking that this thing is way scarier than a bear.
Yeah.
But as far as if they went to the death, depends on how big the bear is and how big the gorilla is, I guess.
Yeah.
Gorillas are so fucking smart, though. I would think that they would figure out a way.
Would you,
to
though?
Fuck a bear up.
Depends on where they are.
Because they're wild, too. I mean, the reason why they have those giant canines, that's to fight.
Yeah.
You know, they fight other gorillas.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of, does he have, like a grizzly bear? You know what's interesting about the way grizzly bears kill? It's really kind of creepy. It seems that animals that kill a variety of things, or animals that eat a variety of things, I should say, real omnivores, which bears are real omnivores, they don't necessarily kill things before they start eating them.
Right.
They just hold them down.
I know. There have been a lot of, in Grizzly Man, I think the guy started getting his legs eaten first.
Yeah, and for 7 minutes, the video goes on.
Jesus Christ.
With the lens caps on, but you're just hearing the sound of him screaming.
Oh.
and her screaming, and this is going on for 7 fucking minutes.
7 minutes?
While this bear's eating him alive.
Jesus Christ.
And that's how they kill you. They eat you alive.
Oh, fuck. That's not good.
All they want to do is hold you because they're so much bigger. They're so much bigger than you.
So the thing is, his paw on my chest, and he's just wolfing down on my quads.
Mostly your gut or your asshole. They'll go asshole first.
What?
Yeah, apparently that's how coyotes always kill. They kill asshole first.
What?
Like deer. Like they found deer that were locked up together. I mean, it's like sometimes when deer, I know you know this.
They may, yeah.
The men are fighting.
Oh, right.
And the men, their horns, because they slam heads together. Sometimes they wedge their horns together in a way that they literally can't get out.
Right.
And there's a video of these, you can find this video of these two bucks that are connected together, and one of them is dead because it was eaten alive by these coyotes, and the coyotes ate it asshole first.
Oh,
so like, the whole back legs and the haunches and the assholes all torn out. Like they ate all that.
And damn.
And this other deer is still connected to him.
Well, he must have been like, eat a little more, please.
No, like that, but it's a video, the actual carcass still attached to the other one. Like it's not like that. It looks awful. It doesn't look like a full deer. It looks like the bottom half is halfway. No, that's not it.
God,
no.
Man. I guess you start with that.
See if you can find it.
One of them can't drink.
I forget the exact way it was phrased in the title. Something about hunters rescue buck. One dead, one alive. Yeah. I don't know. It might be it.
That's weird.
It might be it.
So weird.
It's hard to tell. God, that video looks like shit.
It's just pictures.
It was wobbly, but oh, okay, it's just pictures. Yeah. That's why. Oh. I was like, that's the most ridiculous video ever. That's not it. The actual one was these two. It doesn't matter. You can find it, folks, if you've got more time than us. But they lock horns. They get stuck. And the coyotes just eat them asshole first. That's how they do it.
I don't want it to turn me over and eat my butt.
How about you just stare in your buddy's eyes while you're connected together by the head while he's getting his asshole eaten?
You got to wear him.
He's like, save me. I'm like, I can't. Fucking stuck.
Yeah.
Because coyotes never catch. I mean, they catch fawns.
Oh,
they
God.
Never catch a full-grown buck like that. A full-grown buck, a big 150-pound animal with giant horns.
Delicious.
Coyotes are like, that's too much work.
Yeah.
For the most part.
I bet you it died already and then the coyotes came and ate because the other one was kicking them away. They were like, let's just eat this end.
I wonder.
Doesn't move.
But they're connected together by the head. I don't know. Who knows?
Interesting. But very interesting.
The point being, this is my whole point at the beginning of all this nonsense. I think that the need for separateness, like the need to defend yourself, the need to attack, the need for aggression, was all instilled in whatever animal the human being ultimately became, all instilled to allow it to stay alive through the darkest times, the most primal times. Because without that aggression, guess what, fuckface? You're not going to make it to 2015. If you remove aggression from human history, we're bear food, we're coyote food, we're mountain lion food, we're, you know, fill in the blank. If you remove the need to figure out a way to stop the world around you from swallowing you up, you need to have a certain amount of personal sovereignty and a certain amount of aggression. You have to fight off anything that is predatory, anything that is going to threaten the survival of your very species until you figure out how to get it together.
Sure.
So from the beginning when people made the first houses to figuring out how to make gates to keep other people out to figuring out how to keep themselves safe from predatory animals, and all those steps were like super necessary to get to today. But at a certain point in time, when do we outgrow that expression? That we're so dominant over all the other animals. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And the only problem we have with each other, it seems to be like allocation of resources.
I was about to say.
That's the big one.
You watch how fast people devolve as soon as there's a limited source of water.
Well, and your kindergartner
or whatever may not have enough water for the day. That's when things get really interesting. It's all a question of just what, I mean, most tribes that fought, there was always that situation. It was a fight over resources or water rights or whatever it might be.
Do you
be.
Know that they're pioneering a new desalination plant in San Diego? They're going to spend some untold
$1 billion or something.
Buckets load of cash. Yeah, and they're going to make this desalination plant. If that's true, What you want to do is buy real estate on Catalina Island, because it's going to be a road that leads out to there, because we're going to dry out the ocean.
That's it.
People are creeps.
Desalinization.
Once they figure out desalinization, we're just going to be sucking the ocean off every day. We're just going to be pulling billions of gallons. People are like, if we don't stop drinking out of the ocean, it will be dry by 2075. By 2075, all the water will be in, like, golf courses and bottled water facilities. There'll be no water in the whole ocean.
Just a big, dry hole. Well, they did that, to the Aral Sea? The ecological disaster that was the Aral Sea, and then it dried up in Russia? Is that what it's called, the Aral Sea?
And it dried up because people pulled the water out of it?
It became an ecological disaster for a lot of reasons. And apparently the algae grew so much and there was too much hydrogen in the water. And then there's 1,000 things. And they were siphoning the water off with dams and rivers and it became a disaster.
Dried up Aral Sea, eco disaster.
Aral Sea. There you go. Aral. And you can look out there.
Oh, Aral. Aral
Sea. You can look out there and you can just see boats that are just on dry land, huge ocean liners.
Now, these things, like, how quick do these things happen? Like, when a sea dries up, do they get a 10-year window?
Well, I think the Aral Sea took about 40 years to dry up. But look at the boats out there. That used to be sea. That was all sea. All of it.
Wow.
Think about that. And because of mismanagement and using the water irresponsibly for agriculture, and so damming up parts of it, running off parts of it, they literally got rid of the sea.
Wow.
And that's the eco disaster.
So this was all because of human engineering?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh.
So that was a natural sea, and human engineering led it to dry up. That's insane.
Yeah. It's also very common, that kind of short-sighted thinking.
But it is also fascinating, because you're looking at the underlying mechanisms of the very thing we were talking about, that this human animal is like figuring out all kinds of shit all the time. And it has the power to reshape land now and make areas uninhabitable with an error, you know, or bring them to life with an error, like the Salton Sea. The Salton Sea, for like a long time, like a couple of decades, was this amazing spot where people would go and vacation. They called it like California's Riviera. There was a sea that they created by opening up the Colorado River.
Mm.
And it was an accident.
Yeah.
The whole thing was an accident.
Well, you know,
and now it's an eco-disaster, too.
It is?
Oh, yeah. Now it's horrifically salty and filled with runoff from all the agriculture all across the state.
Yeah.
I mean, all that shit that's trickling down from up north and all the water systems that's going into there, a lot of it, you're getting runoff from farms.
Damn.
You're getting all sorts of shitty things.
Look at all those fish.
That's where it is, man. They have millions of fish die off. The Salton Sea, that's millions.
Damn.
The Salton Sea has so many dead bones on its beaches that its beaches are actually dried fish bones.
Wow.
His beaches, there's entire beaches that are completely covered with white dead fish bones. And you're walking in it and you don't realize it until you look down on
that's
it.
That's crazy.
That is, all that is fish bones.
Damn.
See that? That person's walking.
That is
taking
crazy.
Footsteps in fish bones that are so plentiful that they look like sand. And still has fish in it.
There is when Saddam Hussein was in power in Iraq, there was an area, I think in the south of Iraq, and there lived people called the Marsh Arabs, who had been there for millennia. And when he found out that a lot of Iranian, a lot of the Iranian forces were using it as sort of a hotbed of insurgency and also using it for strategic stuff for the Iran-Iraq war, in one of the greatest ecological disasters ever committed by one man, drained the entire marsh. And go to pictures of the Marsh Arabs in Iraq in the 70s, and you'll see what it looked like. They'd been living there for thousands of years, thousands. It goes all the way back to Alexander the Great, and he drained it in the course of, you know, less than a year and burned it.
Well, that gets back to what we were talking about when we were in the car. We were talking about hardcore history. In the Mongols.
Look at that. It's like, look at that, the way they used to live.
Some people just take things. That's a painting, though.
Mm.
Some people just take things to a completely different level when it comes to like aggression and psychotic behavior, and it becomes a total game changer. It's just like no one knows what to do. It takes hundreds of years to recover from amazing? What this person does.
They say that the Middle East never really recovered from what the Mongols did in 1206 or 1220 or something.
Whatever it was, somewhere in the 1200s. They were saying about Iraq. Like, that was one of the big ones, that Baghdad at one point in time was, like, one of the cultural centers of the world.
Yeah.
Filled with intellectuals. But after the Mongols came, the description was that the river ran red with blood and black with ink.
Yeah.
So all these Islamic scholars who, at the time, like, people have this idea of Islam, especially when it comes to history, like the history of the world, as being this, like, barbaric or very violent group that's willing to kill you because you draw their cartoon character guy. Yeah, obviously there are people like that out there that are become that, that believe in that. But if you go back to the history of the religion, like at one point in time, they were at the front of the line.
That's
when
right.
it came to science and philosophy. They were at the front of the line. And exactly. a lot of people argue that what the Mongols did literally changed the age of the Enlightenment for them. I mean,
that's right, because what it did is it allowed what they did to the Chinese and the Middle East, allowed the Europeans, who are nowhere close to as technologically advanced as philosophically or even as culturally advanced as, say, the Middle East, it allowed them to gain ground on both China and the Middle East because of what the Mongols did to them. Because it had destroyed in the course of, you know, over the years, just destroyed the centers of their civilization, their infrastructure, their canals for agriculture, all of their, just essentially their culture, killed their best and their brightest.
Yeah, it's really amazing how many people they killed. When you look at the number that Dan Carlin cites is somewhere around 50 million, they believe,
God.
That died within his lifetime as a result of the decisions that he made and the orders that he had carried out. Somewhere around 50 million people.
Well, he believed, you know, one of the things he ends the thing with saying, say what you will, the force of his nature, the strength of his nature, he truly believed he was this divine spirit who had a mission to remake the world in his mind's eye. Like, he was the center of the universe and everything belonged to him and his legacy.
Yeah.
What a crazy way to think to begin with.
And the fact that it worked, and he did it all on horseback.
Yeah.
Did it all on horseback, and he had an amazing ability, which one of the things I found most unique about this narration by Dan Carlin was when he was talking about how the guy would, when he would find people that were really talented that were the enemy, he would recruit them.
Yeah.
Like a guy shot him off of his fucking horse.
Shot his horse from under him.
And then he made him one of his generals.
Yep.
And he named him the Arrow.
Yeah.
They called this guy Jebi, the Arrow.
Yeah.
Like the idea that you would take a guy who tried to fucking kill you and shot your horse out from under you. And then say, dude, you're a pretty fucking good shot. You give him some knuckles. Hey, you want to fucking kill everybody in the world together?
Yeah.
Like, all right, I'm in.
All right.
And these guys, they, you know, had an orgy together or something, did some opium, and had a good old time.
Yeah, he could spot talent.
Well, he would take people he would capture people, and he would find out, does anybody do anything? Any of you motherfuckers have any skills? Because if you don't have any skills, I'm going to kill you. But if you got some skills, let me know what you do.
Right.
You know? And people would say, hey, I'm a surgeon. Or, hey, were there even surgeons back then?
Probably.
I could have been a surgeon back then. How about that?
You would have been like, I'm a black belt in jiu-jitsu. What's that? Come roll with me.
Yeah, I'll show you some shit. Come
on. You'd survive.
I would have to. That's what I'd have to do. I'd be like, come on, one of you bitches, let's wrestle.
Goddamn.
Just get them in a guillotine real quick.
Yo. Arm bar.
I bet they knew some shit, actually. When you think about it, like
they
Mongolian
wrestling
is like, but do you think it went back as far as 1200? It had to have. It had to have. I don't know if they talked about it because they were so busy killing each other with arrows and swords and shit and spears and catapults. I don't think the wrestling was like paramount.
You're talking about a group of people, though, that fought with their hands up close, eyeball to eyeball, and did it. And all the guys that we're talking about who were coming into your village or your town had plenty of experience with that in that space. Like, when you're fighting for your life, when you're really killing somebody, I'd imagine it's a very different muscle. You're using very different muscles. You're using a very different mindset. So I would imagine they had a lot of martial sense. They probably were pretty good with hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, they probably knew, like, I mean, you think about, like, the early days of martial arts, there was most certainly a lot of faulty technique and faulty ideas. Mm. They had not taken the most effortless path or the most technical path. They hadn't figured it out yet. Like, there's certainly some evidence that indicates that, because by the time we got, like, the highest versions of martial arts in, like, the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, if you really compare some of the top guys to, like, what's possible today, it seems like it's evolved, like, many, 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 many times.
You know, I think so. I think Hector Lombard is putting a beat down on any fucking Mongol there is.
Every one that ever walked the earth. Hector Lombard is punching through your fucking stupid Mongol
no
face.
Doubt. No
but
doubt.
Those Ruslan Provodnikov-type dudes, that's, like, the same type of dude. That's, like, that guy's an animal.
Uh-huh.
Did you see those pictures of him in the post-fight where he pissed black?
No.
Yes. He put it on his Instagram. He's doing his urine sample, and he pissed black.
God.
Yeah, him and Lucas Batiste. I haven't even seen the fight yet. I got it saved on my DVR.
Lord,
I was on the road.
Have mercy.
They went to war, apparently. It's a fucking unbelievable fight, apparently. I haven't seen it.
Was this UFC or was this?
HBO Boxing.
Provodnikov.
Black urine shows real brutality of boxing. Like, look at his Instagram.
Nah, he's as tough
Go to
as
his
it gets.
Instagram. Look
tough
at that. Look at that picture, man. That's not a Diet Coke. That's his piss.
What?
Yep. That's what his urine came out like.
Oh, no.
After 12 rounds of war. God damn it. That's crazy.
Yeah. How about that fight with Bradley? It's the craziest fight I've ever seen in my
Amazing
life.
Amazing fight. And I think that... The genetics that come from that area, you know, there's from Siberia and from the steppe and Mongols, and there's like the genetics of survivors of hundreds of years, thousands of years of oppression and war.
Yeah.
And he's like super.
It's almost a distillation of, like, the strongest. I mean, the strongest survive just to be born and live to maturity.
People don't like that because it seems to, like, to indicate, like, some sort of cruelty of nature. But I think to really not be objective about it is real cruelty, because then if you're not expressing it for what it really is, you're not seeing it for what it really is and expressing it in an honest way, if you're expressing it through an ideology, you're doing everybody a massive disservice. Because it's pretty obvious that aggression was necessary and beneficial to get us to here. I think everybody recognizing that would help the idea of, like, okay, so if we really did need to do certain military actions in order to stop certain psychos from growing and marching forward and taking over giant chunks of land, just like they have throughout the Mongol days, and this person and Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
There's always been someone that does that, right? So you need some sort of defense to hold that off. Are we agreed? And then anybody who doesn't agree, then you got a real kumbaya problem. Because you got to go, listen, dude, have you ever seen really crazy people? Have you ever been around someone who's willing to kill you for money, for fame, for
your women,
for your women, for your water rights? There's people out there that aren't playing by the rules you're playing by. Where did you grow up? Pasadena. That's a great place. Pasadena is a great place.
Not the Tartar Steps?
Yeah, it's not Istanbul, you fuck. It's not in the middle of Baghdad. Dad in
Big
a place
difference.
That doesn't even have a roof anymore because the soldiers blew it off with their robot flying thing.
Right.
No.
It changes you.
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. So anybody that doesn't think you need some sort of military force until that is all eradicated.
Yeah.
So that becomes, like, the real question. You got to figure out, how do you eradicate all the shitty pockets of life on Earth? And I don't mean, like, eradicate the people. I mean eradicate the problems that make those people shitty. And
that's
seems
a good way
to
say it, by the way, because you have to eradicate the problems and the way a country, the institutions that give rise to evil people. If you have a society that's structured, if you have institutions that are structured so that the only way to get ahead is if you're an amoral motherfucker, then you're going to have people like Genghis Khan et al. Rise to the top. You can't, it's the way a society is structured. You know, they always talk about we have to cure poverty or whatever. The United States is powerful because of its strength of institution. It's powerful because we have courts that mean something, because we have property rights, where you own a house and you actually are secure as an American that somebody's not going to come in and take your house. Very few countries share that luxury today in 2015.
Yeah.
And courts that are objective, that just because you have a lot of money, and I know this is, there are exceptions to this, but just because you have a lot of money, you're getting off for sure. No. We have courts where if you have a lot of money and you kill somebody and you get caught, you have big problems. If you're a cop and you're caught on video shooting somebody, you have big problems.
Well, cops don't have a lot of money, but rich people have been able to really finagle systems with good lawyers. I mean, that is a problem.
It
certainly is a problem.
But not to the extent that it is in so many other countries.
The corruption is not as blatant as it is in so many other countries. I think there's no denying that. I think the real question becomes of one of the customary actions that we've taken. Because what I mean by that is, if you look at people from where we are right now, at the 21st century, 2015, and you consider what people were like just maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, like, there's never really been a time where people have had this method of communicating with each other. So when we used to, we didn't, not only did we not know what was going on in Japan, we had no connection to it. You would read some stuff on paper. There's a guy from Japan that wants to fuck us up. Mm-hmm. This is crazy. And you would have no connection to those people, and you just knew there's some people over there, just like Lord of the Rings, just like, you know, fill in the blank, any war movie from the Mongols to whatever, the Romans. This idea that you would have this group of people that was waiting to come over and fuck you up, that doesn't really work anymore.
It doesn't.
Because there's satellites everywhere. We see everything. We send information to everybody. But this has all happened inside of our lifetime. So there's been a change that's taken place that I don't think we're really fully aware of yet. Mm. There's this weird connection thing that we have to literally everybody on the world.
Well, also remember that when you had an enemy, even as far as even in World War II, the first thing you did was you got your soldiers to believe that that enemy over there, they were subhuman. Yeah. They weren't human. They were subhuman, and you see it over and over again. Again, that's becoming harder and harder to do. Dan Carlin, not to bring it back to him, was also talking about how when you fought an enemy in World War I and you encountered your first line of Germans or whatever, you didn't know how far back that line went. You didn't know if there were a million of them or if there were just 100,000 or 2,000. Mm. So you just fought sort of not knowing just to, not only the effect you were having on their forward momentum, but also on their general population to begin with. Like, you just were fighting, and when they stopped fighting, then you'd find out, holy shit, there were a million of them. We just fought these guys. So just think about that. Now we know where their regiments are. We know how far back they go. We know exactly how many people there are. We can plan accordingly.
Well, not only that, we can talk to each other.
Yeah.
That's what was missing. What was missing was the only people that are talking to each other were generals.
Yeah.
I mean, the generals and presidents were like the only people talking to each other. Listen, bitch, we're going to fuck you up. No, we're going to fuck you up for God. Bitch, God's on our side.
And wars would start because of these alliances.
Yeah.
And they would just be like, well, we're going to fight and break this alliance. And then you'd find out about it as a citizen. You'd be like, but I'm farming my land. No,
I
want
to know how the fuck the Japanese got together with the Germans and the Italians. How the fuck did that happen?
Which war?
World War II. Like, I know how it happened, but how the fuck, if you look at, like, the personalities of the different groups of people and the languages they speak, three completely different fucking languages, three completely different types of people, and all their dictators.
They had a lot of trade and a lot of connection. I mean, but one of the things that the Germans, I mean, Hitler, wanted to create a new world order, and he had a great deal of respect for the Japanese. He considered the Japanese the Aryans of the East. And he had enormous respect for the British.
Really? Consider them the Aryans of the East?
Yes.
How convenient.
Yes. He loved their idea of Bushido, which was the idea of the way of the warrior. Japan had been in a low-grade civil war for really 1,000 years. I mean, it was just constant battles between feudal shoguns, like these fiefdoms. Like, a shogun would run fiefdoms. He'd hire mercenaries, and they would just fight for land. And that went on for really 310 years and about 1,000 years. That's why they're swordsmen and their ability, they were legendary archers and they were just legendary and ferocious. I mean, when the Portuguese were trading with them, they came back and the first thing they said to their European rulers is they said, hey, couple things you don't want them doing. Learning how to sail long distances and learning about a little something we call gunpowder. Don't give them gunpowder. They are straight up the most ferocious group of motherfuckers on the planet. If they're late for something, they immediately request to kill themselves because they've dishonored they're fanatical to authority. And, you know, that proved this tiny island took over a great deal of the world. They were insanely warlike and impossibly disciplined.
And their version of martial arts to this day is being taught.
Yeah.
I mean, once you understand all the, like, Lyoto Machida, who lost this weekend, but still, you know, a great all-time fighter. I mean, he's an amazing martial artist, and his style is Shotokan-based. It's it's based on that
and
style
judo
of karate.
Judo is a Japanese invention, right?
So, yeah. Well, really, jiu-jitsu is as well. I mean, Brazilian jiu-jitsu was modified by the Gracies. It's modified by Helio and Carlos. They modified it and turned jiu-jitsu into what it would ultimately become. They spent much more time on the ground fighting than the judokas. But a lot of the judokas even, like a lot of their techniques, came from, there was an infusion of techniques where there's like some sort of a blurry crossroads between catch wrestling and judo, and some catch wrestlers also taught in Japan, like Carl Gotch and Billy Robinson. Those guys taught a lot of people in Japan, like Sakuraba was a student of catch wrestling. And so he imparted that, like, sort of a lot of catch wrestling submission holds, that style of attacking. He incorporated that in a lot of MMA fights and started a lot of people, not just in Japan, but all over the world, fighting that style. So I think there's many different versions of what Japan has brought out to the rest of the world. There's many different versions. But as far as, like, martial arts, it's one of the biggest contributors, like, ever. They just figured out Aikido, they figured out Judo, they figured out Jiu-Jitsu, they figured out submissions in a way that you really can't find parallel at the time. I definitely think that the Jiu-Jitsu is better now than ever before, and I credit that to the Brazilians. I credit that to the Gracies, and the, you know, Brazil to this day still has a huge number of super high-level jiu-jitsu guys.
Yeah.
Worldwide, it's evening out way more than it ever has before, but I mean, just the overall output and the origins of it, and the fact that it's still called Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Everybody calls it BJJ for a reason.
Yep.
You know, they deserve all the credit. And then there's still guys like Jacare. What Jacare did this weekend to Chris Camozzi, that armbar setup.
God, that transition, like, it's such a, he's a magician.
Artistic. Oh. It was one of the most spectacular forms of like a submission, of applying a submission in a scramble that I've ever seen.
Me too. I didn't even know what he was doing, and I went, how do you defend against that? You can't defend against that.
He's an artist. I was going to put it on my Twitter feed. I'll retweet it earlier today. But I think Grappling World on Twitter, I think that's the ones who put it up. It's they put up like little 15-second GIF, I guess it is, whatever it is on Instagram, and you get to watch it. It's insane. He's so good.
He's ridiculous.
So goddamn good.
It makes you wonder, though, like, with the Japanese, going back to them, how good they were as swordsmen, like what they could have done to you
with
a samurai sword.
Well, that's, again, I think what we were talking about with the Mongols, like, they spent so much time on weapons, because that's how you fought most of the time. Like, how much time were they really spending on learning how to kick people in the face?
Yeah.
It's probably, like, a lot of what we think about the way people used to kick and punch and is based on movie depictions of it. And in movies, like Enter the Dragon or any of these kind of crazy movies, they're trying to do the most impressive stuff. So they're throwing wheel kicks and jumping roundhouse kicks and jumping side kicks. But in real combat, like Bruce Lee wrote very extensively about real combat situations. Like, he was always like completely fascinated by the concept of utilizing minimum effort, incorporating all the best techniques from all different martial arts, and only doing what's effective and discarding what's useless. And he, you know, that Tao of Jeet Kune Do, he wrote like extensively about all sorts of different martial arts, even like lifted whole packages like paragraphs from other martial arts books and put them in there, and people will say like, "Oh, he's plagiarizing." Like, well, no. That's not like what he was doing was collecting all the information. Mm-hmm. You know, whether he attributed it to this book or he should have, or I don't know. Yeah, I agree. Intellectually, probably it's not the most honest thing to do to not credit. Maybe he did credit, but my point is, what his art was absorbing everything. He didn't invent any new techniques, but what he did was he took the best stuff out of everywhere. And he incorporated a system based on his knowledge at the time. Mm-hmm. He took in judo from Gene LaBelle.
He had arm bars and I don't like the way you're talking about him in the past tense. Are you suggesting he's dead?
Bruce Lee's dead, brother.
Wow. Guess you haven't read the secret life history of the alive, Japanese Bruce. Mafia.
Yeah. But my point was that, like, that guy, what he had done is really kind of not just unprecedented, but he was like the first big blip of this new concept. This new concept of just do what's useful.
What was possible?
Do what's useful. Mm. Everybody else before was in a tribe. I was in the Shotokan karate tribe. You're in the, you know, Gong Fu tribe. This guy's in the judo tribe. Mm. And there was very little exchanging of information. You know, I only started exchanging information when I started getting involved in kickboxing because I didn't have good boxing technique. So I started working out at a boxing gym, and then I started hanging out with a dude who was doing some Muay Thai as well. And then I started learning about, like, leg kicks and all these different things. And I remember thinking, God damn, I was so wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, the camp of Taekwondo was good for a bunch of things. But it wasn't good for any of these things these guys were doing to me. I'm like, damn it, there's some holes in this motherfucker. Yeah. And that's the only way you would find out. The only way you would find out is by exploring these other martial arts. But until Bruce Lee came along, that was, like, taboo. You were a traitor. If you went to a different gym to train, you were a fucking traitor.
I remember having been a wrestler, and then I went to Iowa with Dan Gable's camp for, I think it was 2 weeks. It was a nightmare, and 3 weeks. And I got to wrestle with some of those NCAA, like Jim Zaleski, those Hawkeyes.
Christ.
And I, as a 17-year-old, and having wrestled, I knew I had a real appreciation for what a really good D1 college wrestler was about, you know,
mm-hmm.
And. Not because I rolled around with those guys, but not because it was just, they were teaching us. But I knew what tough high school wrestlers were like. And then to think about D1 wrestlers, and then I'd start taking Taekwondo when I went to Washington, D.C. And I used to say to some of my friends, I'd be like, just know that if you're in a bar and you see a dude with closed up ears and he looks like he wrestles in college, that's the guy to be afraid of. Buy him a beer, man. Buy him a beer. Because even if you punch him, you better punch him right. I remember knowing, I was like, I don't know if my kicks are going to work against a dude with a neck like
that.
Well,
in a way, it's kind of what we were talking about. We were talking about the Mongols, where the Mongols lived this life of constant strain and effort, and they were so strong, and the strong survive anyway, like, as far as, like, how many, I mean, they lived in tents, man. These motherfuckers were constantly at war. I'm sure their genes, like, what they had was warrior genetics, you know? And those people, when they encountered regular soft people that lived inside these cities, like, they were like predators to them. I mean, they had disdain for these people, like they were sheep, like they were cattle,
right. Because
they were so fucking strong. I mean, you're dealing with a guy who's a goddamn amateur wrestler, a serious competitive amateur wrestler. You're dealing with a kid who's probably been wrestling since he was a baby.
It's all reaction for him. Everything's reaction.
Not only that, his body has developed by throwing bodies around.
Density.
And much like you can't understand what it's like to lock up with that gorilla, you can't understand how much stronger a Division I wrestler is than you. You really don't know.
No.
Like, you really probably have no... Unless you ever wrestle with one of those dudes and have them grab a hold of your wrists and pin you down and get out of submissions like it's nothing, and mm-hmm. you feel their posture power, they're like several times stronger
than
you
expect.
They're
several times. That's right.
If you get a guy who's like, here's a perfect example. Khabib Nurmagomedov, okay? That motherfucker's a world sambo champion. It's a different kind of wrestling, but the point is, he uses all wrestling. If you watch him fight, he's a relentless grappler. And when he gets a hold of dudes, they're shocked at how fucking strong he is.
I rewatched that Dos Anjos fight, and the way he was
shocked.
On him. Dos Anjos is a monster.
Monster.
And he was just, he was like a... Like an octopus, just like a fucking, just wouldn't get off his back.
He's a motherfucker, dude. He motherfuckers everybody like that. He motherfuckers everybody like that. I'm so excited about this fight with Cowboy because I really want to see what Cowboy does to stop him, and I really want to see how he does with Cowboy fighting Cowboy on top, because Cowboy's guard is fucking nasty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think we've ever seen anybody threaten Khabib with any sort of submission attempts before. And I wonder what would happen. I mean, Dos Anjos didn't get a chance, man. But Dos Anjos has never been like a guard player.
Right.
You know, he's not a big-time guard player. He's more of a top smash you guy.
Is he?
Yeah, he's really good, man. He's so goddamn good. Like, what he did to Pettis was like, whoo!
Yeah.
That motherfucker's strong, too. He's strong
but
and aggressive.
But with Donald and Khabib, I wonder... First of all, I think Donald has better hands and feet.
Well, he definitely does.
Yeah.
He definitely is a better striker, but Khabib is just so much stronger when it comes to like grappling. But Donald, unlike the other guys, is dangerous off his back.
Mm.
Donald has a nasty triangle.
He's also
he throws
taller,
that big,
right?
Yes, he is. He's long. He's got an awesome check knee to the body. He throws that check knee with the left side. He fucks guys up. And he mirrors it a lot of times or hides it behind punches. Like Donald, you'll see, will throw punches where he's not even intending to hit you. He's just getting you look at these. And if you think of moving in and then, boom, that knee comes to the body. He fucks guys up with that. He's putting on a show for you, man. He's dancing like a cobra.
Yeah.
You know, he hides kicks behind punches. Like, he did that when he fought Jim Miller. He showed him the right hand, and boom, the neck kick was right behind it.
Damn.
You know, like, you're looking at that right hand, and this fucking neck kick comes along. Bang! And your legs go out. He's a motherfucker,
if he beats
dude.
Khabib, and this is going to be crazy.
He's a motherfucker. They're both motherfuckers. Donald's a motherfucker, and Khabib's a motherfucker. That is an amazing... That could be easily a world championship fight. That's easily world championship caliber fighters.
I love when they asked him about Conor McGregor, and Khabib says, he's a very, very good fighter, but if he won't come to 155, he's welcome. I make him welcome. He starts hitting his elbow. He's welcome.
Good job keeping that guy off you if you're supposed to be fighting 10 pounds lighter
than
you are.
Good luck! Especially if you're not a wrestler first.
Yeah, well, you listen, man, I wouldn't say that Conor can't fight at 155. What I would say that if he's competing successfully at the top at 145, like he is right now, the transition time, unless he's doing some Mexican supplements, is going to be a long transition time to put on the right amount of weight to compete at that level.
It's a world of difference, right?
Yeah, because he's pretty elite at 145 in his movement, in his endurance. Like, he's not having any problems. And he hasn't been in a real war. And that's what everybody really wants to see. Everybody really wants to see him against a wrestler. Because everybody we've seen has tried to stand up with him, and he's got nasty hands, man. Nasty power, nasty accuracy, super aggressive with his striking, disdainful almost with his stance and his movement towards you. It's shocking, his confidence. And I think that fucks with a lot of people's heads, man. A lot of people, when he comes at you, and he's been talking shit about you for months already, made you feel like an asshole. You can't wait till I get you in the cage. You know, everybody's thinking, like, and then by the time you get in there, like, you've suffered a mental beating already, whether you know it or not. Like, you're at a deficit.
I asked him where his confidence comes from. So how did you, like, you know, he said he has two belts. He was a European national champion in boxing. He's got another belt for something else. But I said, where does this come from? He says, my work ethic. And I said, I know, but a lot of guys work hard. He goes, they think they work hard, but they don't. If it does not involve the fight game, it does not involve me.
Wow.
And that was it. He goes, other guys have extracurricular activities. I don't. I count my money and I fight. And those are the two things I like to do.
Well, he's a game changer. Total
game changer.
He's like Chael times two.
Best thing that ever happened to Jose Aldo's career and profile.
Unless it goes down the way Conor thinks it's going to go down, then it's probably the worst thing to have some guy come along and humiliate you and then fuck you up and you leave with a check. You were one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world, but if Conor could do to him what he did to Dustin Poirier, that would be the most shocking thing we've ever seen inside the octagon.
It'll be crazy. Do you compare Dustin Poirier as a fighter to Jose Aldo?
Of course
though?
Not. No. Yeah. And that's no disrespect to Dustin, because I think Dustin was doing himself a disservice by cutting down to 145. I think he looked fucking sensational in his last fight.
Mm.
He looked amazing at 55. He looked comfortable. He looked thick. He was moving well. He's still fast as shit. I think Dustin's a big boy, and I think those guys that cut down to 45 like that, it's just your body's getting tortured.
Ugh.
And you can kind of bounce back from it. And when you're younger, it's easier than when you get older, when you've been in the game a long time and your body's been taking kicks and punches and, you know, you're dehydrating it every few months and then rehydrating it. Like, after a while, that shit is going to pay, you're going to pay a price. It's going to pay its toll. And I think that a guy who is a really good fighter that cuts less weight and has a less great advantage, but has a full, healthy body and all of the endurance that comes with that and all the peace of mind, knowing that you slept well and ate well and your body feels like really rested. And you probably are better off somewhere on the comfortable side of that than on the comfortable side of too dehydrated. Because those are the people that wind up looking almost like there's points where they're almost like helpless because their body has dehydrated so much and the gruelingness of the fight. Like, there's some guys you never see do it. Like, some guys pull it off like Benson Henderson. He pulls it off, man. He pulls it off. Like, you never see that guy tired. You never see that guy worn out, and he loses a lot of weight. But then when you saw him fight against Brandon Thatch, what you saw is one guy who's enormous, Thatch, who's huge for 170. Yeah. He cuts a lot of weight.
So big.
And Benson wasn't cutting hardly any weight at all, if any, to fight at 170, because he usually fights at 155.
Worked for him, especially.
Worked fucking great. And part of it, you have to consider, is that Benson is a guy with way more experience, way more ways to win, and a way better ground game. I mean, Benson has a legitimate black belt ground game. And his manager and trainer, John Crouch, he's legit as they come. Like, Benson is super good on the ground. He's very good on the ground. Despite the fact that Pettis caught him in that armbar, that was just so goddamn quick and perfect.
Yeah.
But when you look at his real ground game, like when he fought Thatch, you realize, like, you know what, man? It might be better if he fought bigger guys and he was healthy. It might be better because he's so technical. Like, it's not about... It's like the guys who rely on slugging it out and smashing and Hulk smashing dudes, those guys have to be really big for their weight class.
Right.
But the guys who fight like Benson or like Frankie, super technical, super endurance, constantly on you, you know, always cutting angles, always making you work, always pushing you, always putting pressure on you.
I think Benson Henderson is you know, can compete with anybody in 70, certainly Robbie Lawler and any of those guys, and Johnny Hendricks. He's kind of a very similar, he's just as tall, might be a little shorter, but for the most part, I think that there's nobody in the 70-pound weight class that I think gives him a beating, including Carlos.
You know, I mean, he could be a champion at 170, and everybody says that that's ridiculous because it's so, but look, man, that fucking weight class is nuts. All right, anybody on any given night in that weight class could be a champion.
Same with 55.
Rory McDonald could be a champion. Robbie Lawler is the champion. I mean, either one of those guys could be champion, you know? I mean, Condit could still be champion.
Yeah.
Woodley could be champion. Hector Lombar could be champion.
Oh, I forgot about Hector. God, I keep forgetting about guys like Hector.
He's out for a year.
Yeah, steroids.
For the juices, my friend. Mm. He had the juices.
I thought he said that anybody who does steroids should be banned for life. Didn't he say something like that?
Someone gave him a drink, my friend,
that's
and
outrageous.
He did not know what it was in.
Somebody
it.
Rubbed oil on his body when he wasn't looking.
There's some translation issues between Spanish and English or the pharmacy. I don't know, man. Who fucking knows?
Oh, God. I always forget, though, something. Whenever we talk about the 85-pound weight class, 70-pound, I forget about him, and I forget about guys like Yoel Romero. And
well, he's 70 now. Sure. He went down to 70. Hector's at 170. But Yoel Romero, he's another beast, man. It was a bummer that he didn't get to fight Jacare this weekend.
Oh,
that would have been
God.
Insanity.
What happened to him? His
he
knee?
He got hurt. He hurt his knee.
Damn it.
Fuck. That was an insane fight, and then, you know, it became an insane demonstration. See if you can find that that gif of Jacare armbar and Chris Camozzi.
I think if I had to put money on the Yoel Romero Jacare fight, I go with Jacare because I still think Yoel Romero, if he's fighting five rounds, if it's four and five, he starts to gas because he's just there's so much muscle to feed.
So the top one is the guard pass, which was equally ridiculously impressive, and the bottom one is the actual armbar, Jamie. Yeah, that's the guard pass. We just put all that. But look all the weight he put on him with one shoulder, where his whole body's up. Priest turn off ad block. Fuck you, man. Bitches running scripts on your shit. Find it on another, go to another website. But anyway, point being, this era that we're living in right now is like greatest ever for martial arts, I think. I don't think there's ever been a time ever in my life where I've seen this level of execution on a scale like this. It just didn't exist before. It didn't exist when you combine the skill level of the kickboxers, like the glory kickboxers, skill level of the guys that are coming out of Thailand, you know.
It's just all a sharing of ideas, right? Everybody's sharing their own techniques. That's the other thing.
Buakaw. Well, you can watch them online now, too. That helps a lot.
Yeah.
And there's, I just think that overall, jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, and MMA, I don't think there's ever been a time that has been even close
to be represented the way martial arts are represented today. But that's just part of it. The real impressive thing was the transition to that. Yeah. They were in a scramble. That's just the end of it. They were in a scramble, and Jacare dove on his arm and threw a leg over and then hooked him under his leg to keep him from rolling out of it.
So crazy.
And then scooted his hips to the left, and I was watching. I was like, that is art. That's ballet, man.
He's a master. I think you knew what was happening right away, right?
Yeah, I knew he was going for the arm. As soon as I saw him, I think I probably yelled it out. He's diving for an arm. But I could tell that he does that all the time. Some guys don't like to do that because it's a tricky transition between, like, sometimes from the back, some guys will say, you know what? This guy is defending the choke too good. I'm going to set up the armbar. Like, Husamar Paul Juarez did that. To Ivan Salivary. He went from the back to an armbar. There's a video of him doing that same exact transition to Jason Miller. I think that he's got a lot of techniques like that where he can transition from the back to something else. Jacare does. Like, he's got, like, levels of transitions that other people just don't know. Like, I was watching Kamosi, and I was seeing Kamosi trying to figure out what Jacare was doing while he was doing it. And it was just, it was so high level, dude. It was so high level. Like, if you're a guy who does jiu-jitsu, and you watch how this transition flows, this is not, you got to go through, it's before that.
It's really choppy.
Yeah, but it's before that. It's not. It's they missed the whole thing. See, this is just an armbar. This is an armbar, and it's impressive. But that's not what's impressive. What was impressive was the full transition. Go to that Grappling World Instagram. Grappling World on Instagram. That's where I said it was. You could see the whole thing. But the way he does it, it's like you have to have this insane knowledge of where to put your legs in the transition, where he's going to likely wind up, where his leg's going to kick. And there's so much data that he's calculating, and it's all based on technique. Just like it's minimal effort. Like, none of that he did was strength. And that's like the most pure expression of martial arts. I mean, he's certainly strong as fuck. Strength certainly aided him in pulling off the move. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that move was pulled off because of his perfect technique. I mean, you have to be a physically strong person to do anything to a jiu-jitsu person. But there was no resistance there. If you look, there was defense, but the way he moved into that position, he was never resisted.
Right.
Because he was so far ahead of Kamosi, technically. Like, in the dive, Kamosi's like, oh, shit, he's diving. Yeah, where's his legs going? Oh, fuck.
He was
already
ahead of him. He was ahead of him.
He was way ahead of you.
Yeah.
He's way ahead of you.
That's why when you roll with really good guys, they are ahead of you. They've been there before. They've seen what you're going to do. They can predict what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes if they're really good, they can get you to think you're going to do something. You do that, they already know you're going to do that, and then they capitalize.
That's what makes Jacare truly special.
Yeah.
You know, there's two runnings right now for the number one contender after this Chris Weidman Vitor Belfort fight. There's Jacare, who won on the and then Luke Rockhold.
Yeah.
And I think Luke Rockhold made a giant statement by beating Machida and smashing him
and
then choking
him. Didn't Luke Rockhold beat Jacare in
Strike
Force?
Yes, he did. He did.
What's your take on that?
It's a very good fight. Look, I think Rockhold against anybody is a very good fight. Rockhold is a motherfucker, dude. There's no denying it now. After what he did.
Not a good looking guy either.
The only reason why anybody gets laid is because Rockhold didn't get there first.
It's just
if Rockhold got there first, there would be no pussy for anybody else.
That's the bottom line.
He's a handsome bastard. Yeah. But more importantly, what he does inside the octagon is super unusual, man. He's a long guy. It's like Javier Mendez explained it to me in the cage after the fight when I was congratulating him and Bob Cook. Javier said he's long and he's strong. You usually don't get those two together.
Oh.
Because he's a long dude, but he's also yoked as fuck. He's not like a long, skinny, Hodger Gracie-type grappler dude.
Right.
He's long and he's yoked. Yeah. And he trains on a daily basis with Cain motherfucking Velasquez.
God, I didn't know. Oh, that's right. He's in Daniel Cormier's
Daniel
camp.
Motherfucking Cormier.
Oh, God.
So every day, this guy's going to war with the biggest killer the heavyweight division has ever known outside of Fedor. There's just two guys that you can never consider to be the greatest heavyweights ever. There's one who's in the UFC, Cain Velasquez, and one from Pride, Fedor.
Both of whom are don't have. If I saw him on the beach, I would be like, that guy used to work out.
Perfect,
that's what I'd say.
Perfect way of describing Fedor.
Yeah, he used to work out.
Well, in the day, the earlier days of his career, he was a little thicker. Like, there's been this picture of him standing in front of the kettlebells.
Yeah.
What a great picture to jerk off to.
100%. I've dropped a number of loads. Straight loads, but still. just
I'm a straight man.
Why
just admire,
can't I like that? Oh, you Russian bear.
It's all about
you
your
fucking
frame.
Russian bear.
The size of your tendons are bigger, right?
Your traps.
Yeah, there he is.
Oh, God.
Stud.
Long legs.
Stud. All-time great.
High insertion calves.
I mean, it's hard to say.
He doesn't shave his chest, does he? Does he?
He didn't no, give he a fuck. No. It's hard to say, like, who would have won in a fight God. In his prime versus Kane in his prime because they came in two totally different eras.
Yeah.
And if you want to look at accomplishments, boy, it's really hard to discount Krokop beating, or Fedor beating Krokop, Fedor beating pretty much everybody they put in front of him in Pride. I mean, he really beat some of the best in the world. And the heavyweight division in Pride back then was probably, outside of Tim Sylvia and Frank Mir, who in their prime could give anybody a hard time, that was probably the strongest heavyweight division the world has ever known. Because everybody, first of all, was allowed to do all sorts of Mexican supplements.
This is true.
You could do whatever the fuck you wanted, and you were dealing with guys who were fighting for a lot of fucking money. I mean, there was a, you got, think about it, you got Alexander Emelianenko, you got Krokop, you got Krokop in his prime when he was head kicking Vanderlei to sleep,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Oh my good yeah. Googly moogly. You got Minotauro, who was fighting off his back and triangling Mark Coleman off God. His back, like Coleman in his prime.
Crazy.
Coleman was strong as fuck, dude.
There was nothing to triangle. Just a head and shoulders.
Minotauro, when he was off his back, was special, dude. He represented a thing that no one had ever seen before. A real, legit Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt who's a fucking bona fide heavyweight who strangles guys off of his back.
Why do they call him Minotauro? Well. Because he was like the Minotauro. You got lost in the maze of his jiu-jitsu, or what was it?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Well, I'm going to guess that's what it is. Because you don't want to get lost in Minotauro's maze.
Mm, maybe. Maybe it's just like he's half bull. You know? Because he's so
true.
Fucking strong.
Yeah.
It's tough as that guy was tough as shit.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Just another level.
Yeah. Just another level of toughness. So you think about Minotauro. Okay. Fedor beats him in his prime. And Fedor beat Krokop in his prime. They never fought. Josh Barnett and him never fought when he was in Josh's, when Josh was in his prime. Kevin Randleman, remember that?
He beat Kevin Randleman. He suplexed him. And
well,
then he
no, Kevin Randleman suplexed
that's right,
him,
right,
and then
right,
he got
he,
him in an arm bar just
right,
moments later.
Right.
It's like, not good enough.
Right.
I'll break this. Okay, top.
that was the craziest transition.
Yeah. Dude, he was a motherfucker. He was a motherfucker. Fedor was a motherfucker. But if,
his
if
timing,
I look at
his timing with those shots.
Fantastic. Yeah. And his ability to knock guys out.
He
insane.
And Andrei Arlovsky knocked him out.
In the air.
Yeah.
But that was, by the way, a fight where Arlovsky was picking him apart.
Yes, it was.
And that was a fight where a lot of people looked at and went,
mm-hmm.
This guy's got some holes. And it was also a fight where he was criticized by his old trainer. His trainer was saying, you know, he's up to his old tricks. He won with a trick. He's like, but they didn't prepare for this properly.
Ooh.
Like
the,
his trainer was vocal about that. That
yeah,
because
Arlovsky
won.
Was training with Freddie Roach. I think
you're right. Yeah. Well, Arlovsky got crazy and went with that flying knee. And if he didn't go with that flying knee, who knows what would happen? Mm. If he continued to pick him apart like that, it could have been crazy. It could have been crazy to watch Fedor get kickboxed.
Yeah.
You know, but Arlovsky, at least on paper, was a, you know, a very formidable kickboxing threat. He had like one punch knockout power, laser straight right hand. He threw a right hand that when he knocked out Paul Buentello like early in the first round,
yeah.
He threw a right hand that was like a bolt. It's like, yeah. It's like it comes off his shoulder, hits you in your chin. You don't even know what the fuck happened. He's so fast.
Yeah, ridiculous.
When Arlovsky was in his prime, dude, people were terrified of him.
Remember the first time he came in there, they got this 240-pound guy who moved like a small man.
Yeah.
With that ponytail.
Well, when Fedor
goatee.
Got to him, he had lost a few, and he'd been out of the UFC, and, you know, he was fighting for Affliction, you know, but still was pretty formidable. And
so
if you
Kane,
look at his
him
performance
in five then, rounds, who knows?
That's the problem. It's like you'd have to have a time machine, you'd have to coordinate, like, you know, when what version of Kane? Before the first fight with Junior Dos Santos? Before the second fight with Junior Dos Santos? You know, I mean, Junior Dos Santos knocked him out in the first fight, and then they went to fucking war for two fights in a row.
Yeah.
And those fights, you got to think, like, man, Fedor obviously lost a step somewhere along the way, and you have to attribute it, if you don't attribute it to his focus, I don't know what his focus was in training, if his coach is saying something like that, it could be that he was kind of getting tired of fighting, Or it could be the goddamn wars he went through.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody rides for free when it comes to those crazy fucking 10-minute rounds they would fight.
The sparring sessions that he would go through. You know, me, we were talking to Tony Jeffries about this, and he was calculating. And he had 106 fights, 26 of which were pro, I think. And he said, if you look at all the rounds I fought to prepare for those 106 fights, and this is when I became an amateur, it's not when I was a kid, he calculated he took over 55,000 shots to the head.
God damn
55, it. 55,000. And that's so crazy. Typical for a lot of boxers, because you've got to take into account the five jabs, just the five jabs you take a round, even if they're light, when you're sparring.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
So crazy when you just think about all the different micro injuries and different times the brain's rattling against the skull, different little things that have little connective tissue that's separating or twisting or popping or.
I know, but don't you need some of that in life? Like, I was going to ask you,
Head trauma?
No, in Dan Carlin's podcast, this French general, I think, or a British general said, we have to have war because if man doesn't have war, we'll dissolve into materialism. And I thought, all right, whatever, that sounds like a general. But, there is something to be said about a conflict-free world, as we were talking about. And I was wondering, I was just trying to, draw a through line to the people I really connect with, my really good friends, the friends that I have. And it's not that they're all...
I better be on that list, bitch.
You are. But it's not that they're all fighters necessarily, but they definitely have and continue to sort of live in a world that is not, of course, like the Mongols, but they keep themselves a little uncomfortable. They are always in touch with kind of coming up with their own, with a sense of reality.
Well, that's why I told you before, you're the only dude that I'd ever ask to go to Montana to sleep when it's fucking 9 degrees outside in a little cloth house.
Miserable.
It was horrible.
Well, none of the other comics we know are really gonna hack that. I don't think Duncan, and I love him, and Tony Hinchcliffe are gonna like hiking up those mountains in that cold.
Tony might get down with it. I'm telling you, Tony might get down with it. That little fucker is a determined
game.
Little weasel.
Really?
I shouldn't say weasel. I should say I meant to say not weasel.
He's the golden
badger.
Pony. He's the golden pony.
I meant badger. Yeah. He's a determined little. He's like. Weasels are tough little fucking animals, by the way. That's a weird thing. Like, weasel became somehow or another
no, tough as
became
shit.
An asshole. Right. Like, weasels kill cobras, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I think they're
is
in
that
the
a weasel
mongoose,
the kids? Mongoose
they're
killed
the mongoose
a cobra.
Family, yeah.
They're tough little fuckers. But when you say weasel, you're like, oh, the dude's weaselly.
Right.
I mean, he's not to be fucked with. Tony will rise up. He will figure out.
With a pack on his back and that cold?
Eh, you know what, man? Physically, he's not exactly designed for it.
Yeah.
He's not designed for it, but he's a tough little fucker.
Right.
Look at that. Weasel. This photo of a baby weasel flying.
That's a Photoshop.
No, it's not.
Oh, come on.
Yes, someone caught this. It's real
life. Someone caught this? A baby weasel? How did it get on this bird?
I don't believe it.
What? Why don't you believe it? It could happen.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
The world's crazy. Why is that so weird?
That's amazing.
Some baby weasel figured out how to jump on this fucking bird's back?
I'm telling you right now, I think it's completely photoshopped.
Listen, we know weasels exist. We know birds can fly. Why would it be so hard to imagine?
Perhaps you're right. Perhaps the weasel jumped on its back and they went on an adventure.
All the fucking variables in the in the world when it comes to wildlife that this couldn't take place.
Watch this.
I don't think that bird would be able to the weasel would be able to hang on. Look at his little. But also that weasel doesn't have any strength.
Yeah.
That's a baby.
That bird's not letting that weasel on him.
Jamie, please Snopes this and get back to us with the final results. It's actually real.
Yeah.
Wow.
Come on.
Jamie says it's actually real.
I'm still crying. I'm still calling bullshit.
Don't call bullshit. Wow, there's another picture of it. Weasel catches a ride on a woodpecker. What's that guy?
That guy's a liar.
That guy fucked that woodpecker.
That's Ariel Sharon.
Is he?
I don't know.
That's the guy who caught it on camera? Wow. Better not be lying, dude.
Yeah, he's lying.
Those hacksaw dudes are going to find you. They'll find you. You can't lie to them.
Yeah.
They have elite skills with the Photoshop. Layers.
Indeed.
Remember that? Like, these Photoshop guys were going over the fucking image that Obama's birth certificate. Look, it's clearly been doctored in Photoshop.
God.
Photoshop!
Do
you know anything about that, Jamie?
What?
The layers of the Photoshop argument when it comes to Obama's...
No, I don't know anything about that.
Obama's birth certificate was doctored in Photoshop. I'll show you.
Doctored.
If you watch, if you take it apart, the image is several files. Some of them... He's from fucking Kenya.
From several files.
How about this? How about he's from Hawaii, which is not America anyway? How about that?
You know
how
what?
About he's from a country we stole from a
tropical island.
Really nice group of people.
Yeah, they were sweet.
We say it's an island. It's just a small country. That's
I
what
agree.
It is.
I agree.
Hawaiians are Hawaiians. They're not Americans. Right. I mean, they are American in the sense they will take them in, protect them with the Constitution and the military of the United States of America. Pearl Harbor, never forget.
They're in our protectorate. Look at Barack.
But what I'm saying is Hawaii, oh shit, there's two different pictures and they photoshopped him in there?
Maybe.
Maybe? Hmm.
Huh.
Where's the hand? Where's that left hand?
Interesting.
He's got it up her ass in that second picture.
Interesting.
Hmm, this is not real. Hmm. God. Oh, these are hilarious. These are hilarious. Chunk of ear edge missing? Oh, Jesus Christ. That's not even a high resolution photo, you fucking weirdos. Don't they understand the difference between looking at something with a white background and looking at something with a black background? Go up to that ear. I'll disprove this right now, you fucking dummy.
They were talking.
See the difference? See where the transition is? The transition is right where the white meets the black. You know why it happens? Because the fucking camera picks it up like that.
Again, to bring it back, this is becoming the Dan Carlin podcast, but he said something really cool about how people like conspiracy theories because it's really hard to believe that the random just happens or that one man like Lee Harvey Oswald can change the course of history with a bullet. And that's a lot harder to believe than, you know, a group of people who were very organized ended up doing what they did. And it's human. We all want, a logical explanation, not a random one, not the fact that we're fragile enough that one man can fuck everything up with a good bullet or a good bomb.
It's just, it's that time where that was possible. I wonder if that's possible today. And it's certainly to a lesser extent. Like, there's a weirder connection that people share today than they've ever done before. And I wonder how much we realize about how that's shaping societies, how it's shaping just human civilization as a human, you know, we were talking about before, as a gigantic superorganism that relied on aggression to get to a certain point of innovation. And then once it got to that certain point of innovation, when does it no longer need aggression? And when does it need like a realization of what it actually is instead of aggression? When does it need a realization? Like, listen, the only way that's going to work out for everybody is we got to act for everybody. That's the only way.
Yeah.
If the human race just treats everybody that way, like you have to like find where the weak spots are, prop them up, figure out why they're fucked up, engineer them correctly, you know, as far as social engineering, education, counseling.
Are you saying
love,
that we
whatever.
Should do unto others as that we'd have them do unto us?
Exactly.
As Rabbi Hillel and a guy named Jesus Christ said?
And once you get to a point where you have something called the internet and people can exchange these ideas and exchange these points of view and these expressions, like this is how I feel about you, this is how you feel about me, when you communicate like this, you can communicate like this in real time in a way that's never happened before. So they're not like these weird people in Germany that you don't know that are, they have this guy standing on top of a podium and he's screaming shit out and you're like, what's going on over there? Why are they all marching? Why are they all goose-stepping like that? What are they doing with the Jews? Like, what the fuck is going on over there? And you're reading things about it in the paper and you're trying to take these little printed words and piece them into a narrative that makes sense in your head. You're reading the New York Times every morning to find out what's the news with with Europe. What's going on over there with our boys? And you want to look into the paper trying to find out how the score is of the war.
All right.
And you're listening to the radio at night. The fucking radio!
Yeah.
You're listening to the radio!
It's crazy.
They're explaining. You would go to the movies and they would show a clip, a highlight war reel clip of the news while you were waiting for your movie to start.
I know.
What the fuck?
It was very controlled, too. Your information was controlled. War was actually kind of presented in a very sanitized way as well, and in many ways still is. Like the idea that when you get hit with heavy artillery, you come apart. There are not holes in your body. We don't show a lot of that stuff, you know.
Well,
probably shouldn't, but
shouldn't we? I mean, wouldn't it be good for people to know what the fuck they're signing up for?
I don't know. I know that the logic was always that you censored media during wartime and didn't let them show the really horrific stuff because it was bad for morale among troops and at home. Now,
does that make sense to you?
I don't know enough about what it's like to motivate young men to go to battle. I don't know enough about what it's like to be a general or a person in power when I'm in a wartime situation. I don't know what it's like to have the very existence of my country under threat the way we were in World War II when those kinds of policies were made. So I don't know, man. I think I'd have a very different point of view if I was. That's all. And I think we'd all have very different points of view and would do very, very different things and behave maybe a lot like the leaders we criticize if we were under the kinds of responsibilities and pressures that the leaders we talk about were under. I think that if I were the emir, the caliphate of Baghdad, and I knew that the Mongols were doing what they were doing to people and they were on the way to see me, I'd be pretty ruthless with any kind of dissent, any kind of Mongol sympathy, and I would be pretty ruthless with anybody who wasn't pitching in for the very survival of my town.
Right, because the consequences are so high of not taking it seriously and not being aggressively prepared.
Yes.
The question becomes, like, how, if ever, is it possible that because of the fact that we can communicate with each other all across the world instantaneously, how is it possible that we move past the idea of armed conflicts entirely? Like, isn't it possible?
It is possible, and it's already kind of happening.
How can you say that when we're going to war? I mean, we're in the middle of, like, pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan while maintaining thousands of troops.
Yes.
We have bases all over the world.
Yes.
There's this ISIS shit that's going on. There's all
because
sorts of...
Because overall, if you look at the number of violent deaths from 2000 until 2015, according to Steven Pinker in his very well-researched book called The Angels of Our Better Nature, essentially said... It proves and makes the case that fewer people have died violently in that span of time, even with the Congo, even with the Middle East, even with all the things that go on, in comparison to any other time of epoch, any other time in history. And it seems that a lot of countries, like China, for example, China, yes, rattles its sword at Taiwan and things, but China gains a great deal more from being an economic powerhouse. Military powerhouse just isn't, and I maintain this case with Iran. Iran wants hegemony. Iran wants control over parts of the Middle East. Iran has a lot of influence with the Shia, over the Shia-Sunni schism in the Middle East, etc. I think Iran gains a lot more, and we could create incentives for Iran, and we are trying to, at least parts of the government are. Some people disagree with this. I feel like if you created a situation where Iran saw that there was much more to be gained from joining the economic community and playing ball in accordance with its laws, than in getting weapons of mass destruction.
They're all scared that those chicks are going to find out they don't have to wear burqas in America. And they're going to come over on boats.
Cover your face.
Come over on boats, and they're going to seek out black dick like a magnet. Like a magnet to steel filings.
Perhaps.
They're tired of being suppressed. They want to twerk on some dude in a club.
Maybe.
With no crazy, funky religious outfit on. And they can escape. You know why? Because no one knows what the fuck they look like. They could just blend right in. Good
in
luck
out
with your passport photo when it's looking through a fucking lid of a garbage can like Oscar the Grouch.
In and
that's
out,
what that's what your fucking passport looks like. You see your eyeballs. I mean, they have to take their shit out for their passport, right? Don't they? Are they allowed to? It's like stealing their soul or something, right?
Well, the minute that a lot of Saudi women go to places like London and Kuwait, guess what comes off immediately?
Their headdress, the whole burqa
immediately
thing.
And they go shopping, and they dress in sexy outfits, and they're just like, yeah, because...
Suppression, man. It's just amazing that you've got countries that in 2015 still make women dress like they're in Star Wars.
But there's another reason for it. There's another reason for it. There was another very logical reason for it.
Logical?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're a religious man and if you are trying to create a productive society, the logic went, if you have women walking around looking all sexy and naked, which was a lot of the Middle East. If you have that, what happens is we're thinking about fucking and not producing.
Yeah.
So you gotta cover your chicks up, damn it, if you want to get any work done.
That's not true, though, because America produces like a motherfucker.
How about that? How about that?
We got hot freaks over here.
It's so true. Freedom. Freedom.
Is that what she looked like, really?
Princess Leia.
Princess Leia? Is that a real body?
Yeah, it is.
Damn, she had a banging body.
Yes, she did.
That was real, too. That was pre-suck and tuck.
God bless her.
You know, she didn't have no lipo.
Couldn't look more bored.
She was beautiful at the time.
Very exotic, I must say.
Princess Leia.
With a steel bra.
She made out with her brother. Remember that shit?
I love it.
She kissed her brother on the lips and his dick got hard.
Is that true?
It had to. He didn't know that it was his sister. That's rude. Your sister comes along and gives you a real kiss.
With a body like that?
Yeah.
Sis, you got some tits on you.
She didn't even bother telling you that she's... Did she know at the time? Did she know she was... No, no one knew. No
did you ever
knew,
have right? to do a love scene when you were an actor back
no,
in the day?
I wasn't an actor. I was never really an actor. I did acting work.
I had to do some serious love scenes. It's always awkward and weird.
I bet, man.
Because I'm
as
an
awkward
actor.
And weird as it is being in a car with you for 6 hours driving up to turkey hunt.
How about that, huh?
We had a good time, dude.
We did have a good time. We it's always have. I will always hunt because it's just people like, why are you going? It has nothing to do with killing the animals. For me, it's I get to hang with you.
Yeah.
And we get to be idiots and laugh.
It was like I was saying, like there's not a whole lot of dudes I'd ask to sleep in a tent. You know? Come on, man. We're going to go. We got to go to some place. Like, I'm calling my TV star, you know, famous comedian friend. Going, come on, dude. We're going to go. We're going to sleep under the stars in Montana.
Napa Valley.
We're going to go shoot deer and then we're going to eat them
yeah.
over a campfire. Are you in?
Turkey hunting was interesting. I can't give it away, but I will say that I killed between 0 and 10 birds.
That's a good number. You know, turkey hunting is very exciting. It's fun. But the only issue that I have, and I don't really have an issue with it, but the only thing that I would say if it came to like preference of time that I would spend hunting, I would spend less time turkey hunting and more time doing other things because of the fact that you can't get anything more than a turkey.
Yeah.
You stay there all day.
Yeah.
You shoot this turkey. You got one turkey.
Yeah.
And that's great. I mean, it'll be delicious. I'm sure I haven't cooked it yet. I've got it in the... Oh, I told everybody I killed a turkey.
Or did you?
Well, there's no... Ranella had a picture of it. He put it on his Instagram, so I'm fine. But it's just a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we tasted some of it. We ate some
tastes
breast.
Tastes just like turkey.
It tasted like turkey. It was good, but the breast tasted identical to turkey.
Yeah.
Apparently, the legs are like a little tougher. And the one that I got was apparently a good one to eat because it was fairly young.
Yeah.
And those are like more tender.
Called a Jake. It wasn't a Tom.
A Jake. Yeah. And they just don't, here's the deal, you know, there's not that much food there.
No.
You know, it's like it'll feed a family, and then maybe you might have sandwiches the next day. If you shoot a deer, like if you go out and you shoot a deer and you spend those nights sleeping in the tent in Montana and you're successful, you're going to come back with 50 or 60 pounds of meat.
Incredible.
I mean, you've got backstraps and loins and burger and you're making sausage out of it and you got
just,
all
just butchering it just
yeah.
butchering it is a bitch.
We did it for hours.
Oh.
We butchered it and we, you know, joked around. We had a great time. Oh, that moose. See, if I shoot one of those, that moose, I'm gonna be eating that moose forever.
One of the greatest pictures I've ever seen, that picture and the Fedor picture with kettlebells are the two pictures I use in my fantasy files.
Well, this picture is like what it means to eat animals. That is a moose leg.
God,
I don't know how much that thing weighed, but it was heavy. It was
100 pounds?
Well over 100 pounds.
My
well over 100 pounds. Well, it was a 900-pound moose.
Jesus Christ.
Which isn't even that big.
Look at that
my
power.
My friend Ben, he shot one that was about 1,400 pounds.
What?
It was much bigger than mine. It's huge antlers. It was ridiculous. But that moose is going
to
feed me for a year.
Like, I need to come over and get some
worth
moose
of meat.
Meat.
Yeah,
still
come
haven't
on
had
over.
Any.
Come on
you
over,
good,
man.
You have good cuts?
Yeah. Well, let me show you how to cook it, because it's not easy.
No.
It's a different thing. It's different than deer. That's a gladiator animal that you're eating.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, when you eat the meat, I'm going to have you over. We'll come over to the house, and you and I will sit down. We'll have a meal together.
All right.
I'll cook you a real moose steak. You're going to eat it.
I'll bring the wine.
You're going to be like, holy shit. Because it makes you, it's almost like a stimulant.
Well,
like, there's so much energy in that meat.
Listen, I've done that with deer meat. I ate deer meat every day for 10 days. I'm telling you, and I'm not hokey, you get a rush. Like I had an extra kick in my body.
It only makes sense if you look at their body. Their flesh is so healthy. Like their tissue is so rich and red and dark.
Yeah.
Like you're dealing with an extremely healthy animal that is surviving against really hardcore predators. I mean, it's running away from mountain lions and wolves. Like, this is existence.
Right.
For a moose, it's wolf packs. You know, if you make it from the time you're a calf to the time you're a full-grown moose, good luck. I did ever show you that picture that I had? We came across one that had been torn apart by wolves?
No.
Yeah, when we were up there hunting, we came across a moose calf.
Wow.
When we were actually moose hunting. And this thing had been torn apart.
So you were up, you were up in wolf country.
Oh, yeah. Not only was I up in wolf country, I was up in a place where they don't even have a limit on how many wolves you can kill.
Because there are just so many.
They want you to kill wolves all day.
Damn!
They want you to, they set up bait. You can do whatever you want.
Because they're such a motherfucker.
They're just such a motherfucker. And they don't have a handle on them at all. The guy that I lived up there, that stayed at his place, rather, that lives up there, his neighbor lost a cow to a wolf.
Well, when we were in Napa Valley, the farmers I was talking to, they used to keep emus, like which are miniature ostriches and lambs, and said the mountain lions wreaked havoc. The mountain lion would come in and pull those emus over the fence, the 7-foot fence, and they just find feathers on the top of the fence. There goes our emu and lambs too. Just eat the shit out of a lamb.
Well, the place where you and I were staying up in
that's where it was.
Yeah, the place where you and I were staying, they lost all their sheep.
To mountain lions.
Yeah. This farm that we were at. I mean, they had all these cows and shit.
Think about if you have to survive the winter and a mountain lion and wolves are killed. You'll start hating mountain lions and wolves. That's why they got hunted.
There's a totally different idea that you and I have about them. Like, you know, you look at a wolf, you look at it, it's like a dog.
Yeah.
That's not a dog to them. That's a dangerous
starvation.
Fucking thing.
Yeah, starvation.
It's a dangerous fucking thing. I'm trying to find this guy.
When you're in the frontier and wolves took care of all your livestock, your kids couldn't eat.
Yeah, man. Well, it hasn't been... Okay, I found the pictures. It hasn't been that long ago that human beings really had to worry about wolves. That's why the big bad wolf and all those different, you know.
Well, those legends
guys,
go on in Europe forever.
That's what we found. We had gotten there probably the night after or the day after.
Oh, so it still had like blood
still
on it?
Still had some meat on it.
Wow.
Yeah, and what I didn't expect was the hair everywhere.
Oh.
Like all that stuff that you see on the ground in that picture. Jamie, you can pull it up. It's on my Instagram.
That's hair.
If you find a body of a moose calf, it's from 4 or 5 months ago.
Damn.
The hair was all over the place.
Leg still has.
Yeah, they would have come back. They probably were going to come back and finish off the rest. Or they were just full and they were going to go somewhere else and get something else. But they always know where it is. They'll come back.
Where was that?
That was in BC, like northern BC.
British Columbia.
Yeah. Dude, when you meet people at the airport, just a random guy at the airport saw that I had a camo jacket on and asked me if I was hunting. He talked to me about how much he likes to kill wolves. He's like,
really?
Yeah, these city people, they just don't understand, you know, they live down there in Vancouver and they're making all the laws for up here. And, you know, we're the ones who have to hear them howl and, you know, and wonder how many of them there are out there. And they kill your livestock and they kill your dogs and
different perspective.
They're wolves like the movies, like Little Red Riding Hood. Like, look out, little girl. Don't go off in the woods alone because there's wolves out there.
Slick, too.
Oh, they're so smart. They follow.
What's our next hunt? Are we going to pig hunt?
I don't know.
Let's pig hunt.
We could pig hunt. You know what I was thinking? I was thinking we should go caribou hunting.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Real cold.
Alaska.
It's too cold.
Caribou.
It's
no, it's not.
Too
you're
cold.
Going in the. You're going in August.
Oh, I'll go then.
Yeah, they migrate in August.
All right.
Yeah.
What about before that?
I don't know. We'll figure something out.
I want to kill a pig up
in
Sacramento.
Oh, you're crazy. You're violent.
Yeah.
What happened to you?
I want to eat a pig.
Oh.
I need some pig. I love pork.
I still have some from the pig I shot.
You do?
Yeah, I'll cook some at the house. I made a ham, like, maybe...
You still have all my hunting gear at your house.
I have your hunting gear. I made a ham. That's us. We're turkey hunting.
Look at that.
So sexy.
Look at me.
But I made this ham that I slow cooked on the smoker for like 6-7 hours.
God damn.
I brined it for like 4 or 5 days.
Jesus.
You brine it. Like you take ice, put it in a cooler. You take this brine, which mostly is like salt and sugar and some spices, and you dunk this ham in there and then surround everything with ice and put it in like a Yeti cooler.
Mm.
And then, see, look at that. Jeez,
wow.
Nice. That's fucking...
You're getting to be quite the meat cooker.
Yeah, I'm getting good at cooking meat. Like, I'm no chef. I don't have skills. I don't know what I'm doing. But I do know how to smoke meat. I knew how to grill steaks. I cooked a cowboy cut last night. Yeah, he's like a real chef.
Yeah.
Like, he could be like a real chef.
I tell people he made me beaver, and I said it's some of the best meat I've ever had. Get out of here.
Those are some ribs that I cooked.
You're so funny
delicious.
That you post. I follow you on Instagram, obviously. And
I love
always posting
food.
Meat.
That's what I cooked last night. Cowboy cut of ribeye.
Damn it, that
looks
good. Come
on, son. That's artwork to me.
Is that moose?
No, that's ribeye steak.
Fuck.
That's a regular steak. I got a cowboy cut, a big, thick. It was probably like maybe 3 inches thick. At least 1, 2, 2.5 maybe. It was a fat, thick one where I had to use a thermometer to cook it. So I cook it on the outside. You sear the outside on these things called grill grates. I got to show you this smoker I got. It's a Yoder. It's it uses direct heat as well as indirect heat. You ever seen those things, those pellet smokers?
No.
Well, this one, you can sear it on one side, and then you move it over to the other side, and then you just leave the temperature at what you want it. For me, it was like 400 degrees. So I drop it down to 400 degrees, and I have a thermometer in it. It tells me when the temperature, the internal temperature, hits like 125. And then I watch it carefully until it gets to be about 130, and then pop that bitch out and let it sit for 10 minutes.
So you're roasting it.
You're starting it off grilling it.
Right.
You're starting it off grilling it. It's direct fire, like fire literally below these grates.
Yeah.
And you sear the shit out of it. I don't mean the shit out of it. You don't want to burn it. But you want to sear it for, depending upon the thickness of the meat and the temperature that you're searing it. I don't do it for more than like 2.5 minutes a side.
Mm.
And I just really just like cook the outside. You know, you're burning off any possible bacteria that's on the outside. You get a nice crust and a good, like a delicious, like, top area of it where it's like real crispy, and you got like kosher salt and black pepper and a little bit of garlic powder I mix on there, and I let it sit for like an hour before I put it on the grill. It's an art form to it, man.
Yeah, it is.
It is, because it is. Like I post pictures of it because I like when other people do too. Like I like looking at people's Instagrams and shit that they're making.
My father-in-law can cook the greatest steaks. He uses hickory chips, and he smokes it that way on the grill. He's just a master with a grill. I try to replicate it. I just can't do it, man.
Yeah, there's two different styles of cooking steaks. Like some people like the Argentine style, which is like a slow grill, slow and low. They'll cook like a steak slowly.
I like my meat to be a little raw, though. You know, yeah. Or just like rare.
No, but I mean, they can certainly still cook it rare. They just cook it at a low temperature. Mm-hmm. They don't like American style grilling a steak. You know, you see that steak hit the, you know, thing, and you flip it, or you move it a little, and then you flip it, and then you push it off to the side, and you always put the lid on it and you let it rest. Like, you got to let it sit. Like, you grill the top of it, but unless it's a really thin steak, that's not going to really get the center where you want it. It'll be really rare in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you put it, like, if you have a either one of those Webers, or I have a Kamado, you put a top lever to it, so that the heat is not really underneath it anymore, cooking it from the bottom. It's cooking all around it. And then you put it on the top, close the lid, and it'll drop down like maybe 350 degrees or somewhere around there. And then you cook it slowly for the next, like, depending upon the thickness of the steak, I don't usually like to go more than 5 minutes. And then I pull it off of there. So what I've done is I've seared the shit out of the outside with like really hot flames and a hot grill grate. And it's everything is just like, it's really cooking the outside of it, but then slow cooking it after that, so you get that.
They do it all kinds of ways
on the outside.
I had a Wagyu steak in Utah where they put it in a plastic bag and they boil it.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a new thing.
Such a weird thing. But God damn, it was good.
That's a thing.
Snake River Farms. Ooh,
is really popular right now. They have new ones that they sell that you put a pot of water. You know, and then you stick this heater element in it, and it cooks it for you. You just like sit it on the counter, but it's not or sit it on your stove, but it's not the stove that's cooking it. It's this device that you have in the water, so it'll keep the water steady, 135 degrees, which is like medium rare.
Yeah.
So you would just do that, and it would cook it perfectly. Like, you couldn't fuck it up. It couldn't overcook it. And then you take it, and they cook the outside of it with like a torch.
Right.
Like, I take a butane torch and they crispy sear the outside of it, and it's supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, I've had it. It's incredible.
I don't like that Wagyu shit, though. I don't like that fatty.
I had Wagyu sent to me from Snake River Farms, which apparently, like, I went to Mastro's, and the guy goes, well, Snake River Farms is the best. Dude, I don't know what they do there. I don't know what they do with those cows. I'm just telling you, it's the best steak. It's better than venison. It's better than anything I've ever had.
You might like different things than I like, because I've tried that Wagyu. I've given it a bunch of tries. I've had Kobe.
Too fatty.
I like lean.
Something about this is
that's
just
what I like about like that what the fuck? Tri-tip that we had.
I like lean, too.
Yeah.
I'm more of a lean guy. I don't like a lot of fat, and this was an exception.
Maybe there's just the preparation. Maybe the chef just nailed it.
No, because they sent me my own steaks, and I just cooked it in fucking butter, and I was just still like,
really?
Like the best steak I've ever had.
All right, well, I'll give it another shot. I've had it before. I didn't like it. I felt like I was eating a patient.
I'll call them, the guy. I think I know the guy. I'll have him send you some steaks.
I felt like I was eating a bedridden patient. Like, you took a cow and just stuffed Fruit Loops down its fat face and got it drunk every
every night and then killed it.
I'm curious to see what you think of the Snake Rivers.
Yeah, I'll try.
They have it to a size. Apparently, there's other places that do Wagyu, and then there's Snake River Farms. Like everybody who's in they all say, well, that's the Cadillac, that's the Mercedes, that's the Ferrari of snakes.
Again, another Japanese invention, those slick bastards.
Rub them with beer, don't they? And they do all kinds of weird shit with the cow. They don't let it move. Not very nice.
That whole culture, when you think about one small island, just think about what they did to revolutionize the car industry.
Yeah.
They made cars reliable.
Yeah. With insane cooperation. And I'll give you an example. With the Toyota plant, this is back in the day. This is 20 years ago. In Toyota Company, they could start from when they started with the one piece that was they were going to put the car together. On the assembly line, it took 5 minutes to assemble an entire Toyota.
How about you take 10 guys? Just make sure the bolts are tightened down. Yeah. What the fuck, man?
How about
don't
that?
Rush my car.
I know.
Make sure there's bolts on.
5 minutes.
That seems like a little quick. Maybe slow down.
I think so, but they have it down to a science. They always say that Japan was so heavily influenced by one factor, a lot of people in a very small area.
Mm.
And it required a great deal of cooperation, but even more importantly, because of typhoons, their architecture was made from rice, because you didn't want a wind to blow stone on you and die. So the reason that the origami, like, you know, they have like sliding glass doors and, I mean, paper, a lot of their houses were made of, the inside was made of paper. Well, the problem with that is when you have walls that separate you that are made of paper, you can hear what goes on in the room next to you. And if you have a couple that's fucking or whatever, or crying or arguing, now you're privy to their business. And what that did was they said, how are we going to run a society like this? This is weird. I mean, I know he's listening to me, and then I'm listening to him. And what a lot of social scientists talk about is this idea that the Japanese got super good at actively not hearing things they're not supposed to. And it was like this sort of social contract where, first of all, you never mentioned that you heard anything. Second of all, you didn't even gossip because you didn't hear it.
Hi. Hi.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
I'm not listening. I'm not listening. I am jacking off, but I'm not listening.
What a bizarre culture.
Yeah.
That they exhibited so many unique traits and characteristics, yeah, and had so many unique strengths. You know, I mean, if you think about their contributions just to martial arts alone, for one island like that, it's unprecedented. I mean, the other island, I mean, Brazil is obviously an enormous country, and there they had a massive influence on as well. Holland is a small country. They had a massive influence, yes, on kickboxing, yes, and Muay Thai.
And on the economy of the world. I mean,
Holland,
Netherlands owns,
sure,
a lot of they are an economic powerhouse
and responsible for setting up shop in Africa,
and
you know?
and I believe in a place called New York and other
New
places.
York.
That's right.
If I can,
the Dutch
make it there. I was just there. Just yeah.
I always confuse Denmark, Holland,
New York.
The Netherlands is the same as Holland. Yeah, all of that area.
Yeah, you can fuck up.
You're a Dane. You're from Denmark. What does that mean? Are you Okay? Are you
Dutch?
Are you Dutch? Are you from
Swedish?
Holland? So you're from the Netherlands, you're Dutch, you're from Holland. It's always confusing, but
they also figured out weed and hookers a long time ago.
They're great.
They figured out a lot of shit. They're like, let's just, like, how about you just get tested and do whatever you want to do? And
the only issue with the Japanese is that their challenge has always been innovation. Like, they're really good at mimicry and making things better.
Mm.
But as far as, and the reason for that is because of the way their society is structured, so that if you are someone who comes up with a better way to do something than your boss would lose face.
Oh.
And so that's why a lot of things stayed rather stagnant, even though they were good. It was very hard for them to sort of keep up with the so not as much innovation comes out of Japan. They don't really have a Silicon Valley the way we do.
Wow.
And that's an
interesting way of describing it.
If you have a boss and you go out to drink, the boss drinks a higher caliber whiskey than you do.
Really?
So
what
he'll
a
drink
dick.
Cutty Sark and you'll drink something on
boss
lower.
Is a shithead.
Yeah.
Give up the good booze, son.
Listen, man.
Come on, bro. You make more money. Give
authority.
Up the good booze. Come on. We work together. Let's be friends here.
Authority. And also very chauvinistic. Mm.
But they did some amazing improvements on existing things.
Yes.
Like, that's what their unique characteristic, their unique traits, especially when it comes to automobiles
electronics.
And electronics.
Yeah.
Like the NSX.
it forced Ferrari and Porsche to change the way they were making cars. Like, wow. They came out with this fucking NSX. I want to say like 91 or 92 was the first NSX. And it was basically like a super evolved sports car. For the time, it like had these ridiculous things that they had built into it, like baffles in the fuel lines to make sure that the weight always stayed completely central. Like, they wanted to have like a pure 50-50 weight balance, so it's a mid-engine car, so the engine is behind the passenger seat. All these unique innovations to the suspension geometry and the way it handled was just like it was on rails, man. And it was not even a high horsepower car. It was like 275, I think, initially, maybe 290 towards the end of its production line. It wasn't like that speedy. It was just bulletproof. It was all aluminum. No one had ever done that before. No one had ever made an all aluminum sports car.
I remember getting in that car with you when you first got it.
It's amazing.
And you were just like, you were telling me about it.
The engineering is unprecedented, and they lost money on everyone they sold.
Wow.
They didn't make money on that car.
Why did
they
make it?
That was a flagship car, just to show you. Look, not only are we going to make something that's better than any of your shit, it's not going to break down, ever. It looks awesome. And we're going to lose money selling it. Fuck you.
Damn.
Just shut your mouth.
Damn.
And they kind of do that with the Nissan does that now with this thing called the GTR. They have this car, the GTR. It's actually more expensive now than it used to be for a while. It's like they're barely breaking even on it. But I think now they realize it has such a demand that it's you can kind of charge more money. And they've continued to innovate it. They continue to... It's like a samurai sword. They built the samurai sword, and I want to say the NSX came out in like 2007 or something like that. I might be off. But from that time, they've just made a better version every year. Mm. Every year. Every year. Every year. That's what it looks like now.
Wow.
In 2015...
How much does that cost?
That's 100-something thousand, but it is a fucking spaceship.
Really?
I rented one of those when I was in Austin at Hertz. Hertz Rent-A-Car will let you rent a fucking NSX.
That's hilarious.
So I rented an NSX, and me and the Hinchcliffe machine were fucking tooling around.
Just zipping around.
Dude, that thing is the fastest fucking thing I've ever driven.
It doesn't look like it either. That's what I like about it. It's such a... You know, it's kind of an understated sports car.
That's not a GTR. What is that? It's got different taillights.
It's a Mazda.
Unless it's got... No, I think it's just got unique taillights. Is that a real one?
It might be modified. That might be Photoshop.
Maybe. The real taillights are... Go back to the previous image that you had. That's the real taillights. They're really cool looking. It's a spaceship, man.
Wow.
The way it handles, it's all like... The thing that people don't like about it... The people that don't like it. Most people love it. But the thing that people are a little perturbed about it, look at that. That's the outside.
Okay, so
of
that's
it.
The Nissan. I kept thinking we were looking at an Acura. Okay,
no, there's a new Acura NSX that's coming out as well.
So.
But it probably won't
can't
be.
Keep up.
Go back to that image, that rear end image that you were just showing. Look at that fucking thing. I mean, that might as well be in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Look at the fucking, the way it's built. And all of that is aerodynamics. Like all that shit you see around the back end, all that shit around the pipes, that's all designed for downforce, extreme amounts of downforce.
Downforce is super important to me.
Well, that's why it has that tail in the back of it. That's all about keeping the ass end down, because this thing has such fucking insane power that sometimes they can catch flight. Like, there's one in the Nürburgring.
So that's why you have that goddamn wing?
The wing, yes, yes. Yeah. But still, because of that, sometimes they get back-end heavy, which means the front end comes off the ground, and they go flying through the air.
What?
Yeah, it happened recently at the Nürburgring. The Nürburgring, look up this, GTR crash at Nürburgring. It's a crazy thing to watch, because you realize this is not just a crash. This is a guy that has no control of his car, because the car's wheels aren't touching the ground.
Right.
It's flying. It's crash, not grass. Okay, let's go to videos. That's it, right there. Bam. Watch this shit. Oh, you motherfucker. Watch this shit. This hurts my, like, my anticipation hurts my, like, adrenal glands. Look
whoa!
At this.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Yep. Look,
oh,
he's
that's
going,
crazy.
Yeah, watch that again. He's going around the corner. That's why, somebody died, man. Somebody
no.
died in this. Yes, they did.
Got hit
watch
by
this.
The car?
Yeah,
what?
Got hit by the car.
Oh,
look at this.
Shit.
He's coming over the hill, and it just catches flight. Like, he's scraping along the back bumper, like, just skipping through the air. Fucking crazy. The front end came so far off the ground that the car literally was bumper to the
ooh,
ground. Like, look at that. The
my.
Bumper's on the ground. Dude, it went upside down even.
How fast is he
the
going?
The wheel actually caught it from going upside down. It goes back forward again, and it flips.
God,
oh, he's going ridiculously fast. But that's not what the problem was. The problem was he lost control. I mean, it's not about going fast. It's about when do you go fast and when do you slow down. And you got to know a circuit like the Nürburgring. The Nürburgring is the most famous of all circuits when it comes to testing a car's lap time. Like, if you can get a really fast lap time at the Nürburgring, it's worth millions of dollars because that car will be the new king of the Nürburgring. The GTR was, like, I think one of the best production cars in terms of lap times. The fastest for the longest time was a Corvette ZR1, this fucking insane 650 horsepower Corvette, but now the new Corvette Z06 is even faster than that. And every year, everyone's trying to get a faster lap time on that track. But here's the problem with that track. That track sort of mimics the real world in a sense that it's not like a flat line.
Right.
It's not like a flat circle, like a NASCAR thing. But there's ups and downs and twists and turns. I mean, you're changing levels. You're going
so
up
it's,
and
it's,
down.
It's what you get from a real, it's a real test of
it's
a car's.
It's a real test of a car's ability in the real world. So that is particularly disturbing because that guy's coming off that hill like that with the kind of power that a real GTR that you could buy in a store has. And he's going flying through the air.
Jesus Christ.
So you have to stop and think. Look how beautiful that is. My God. Is that's that where amazing. The crash took place?
That's the Nürburgring.
Oh, my God. Look how beautiful it is around it. It's amazing.
Two things I've never seen. When people stand too close to car races like that with no protection.
Oh, they're crazy.
And guys who are watching golf when the guy tees off and they're literally right in the line of fire.
Yeah, that's a good point. This especially, though, right?
Damn.
Look how beautiful that is, man. You're flying around next to this unbelievable countryside. Yeah. It's so gorgeous.
There are parts of Germany and parts of Switzerland and parts of France that are just like that, that blow your mind. Then you go into these little towns, and they've been there for 1,000 years.
The issue with this racetrack, though, apparently, is that it gets a lot of inclement weather. Like, you'll watch a bunch of laps they'll do when it's raining out and shit. Like, in the UK, you know, like Top Gear, it's one of the hilarious things about Top Gear. Is that so often they're testing cars and it's raining. Like Chris Harris, who's a guy I've had on the podcast before, is like one of my favorite automotive journalists. So many times he's driving a car and it's raining out.
Really? And he's testing
it
in the
UK. Yeah, he's in the UK. It rains all the fucking time.
Why do you think, and maybe this is, maybe not so, but is race car driving more popular in Europe than it is in the United States?
I would say so, yeah.
Like Formula One, they're
just like dumb racing.
Black is going left again.
Not NASCAR.
He's going left.
Swapping
again.
Paint.
They're swapping paint.
Why
this
does he have a southern
crazy.
Accent? Why does he have a southern accent? Because that's most of the people that listen.
Damn it.
What if I did it like
you're contradicting yourself.
What if I what accent?
Why
would be
can't he speak this way? It looks like they're swapping paint at the moment.
They're going left. I'm in love with this Chevron car.
It's gaining ground on him. I tell you, man, it's unbelievable.
The way he continues to turn left baffles the mind.
It's outrageous. He's doing irreparable damage to his reputation and to his chassis.
How can he do it with such accuracy?
No.
The art form.
Outrageous. Now they're fighting.
There's a weird culture. The English man. They're eagleness and their way they have like set up all these different sort of patterns that they follow.
Oh, yeah, it's all
dress
about
and behavior,
self control.
Do you play snooker? A man plays snooker.
Yeah.
A hooligan will be playing eight ball at the bar, but a gentleman prefers snooker.
Knowing your place, discipline. The British were always very disciplined about like protocol, what's to be done, what's not to be done. Made good soldiers. Oh. Mm.
Until they figured out, Americans figured out, just shoot at that white stripe that they keep in the middle of their chest.
That was a long time ago.
Dumbasses. That shit didn't even work. But it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
People, their folly. They need to learn.
Well, they were wearing wigs and they had wool coats on in the heat. It sucked.
What was that about? Like, what was the wig thing about?
Protocol.
Like, the powdered wigs? Like, why did they have powdered wigs?
There was always a form of, even the French up until World War I wore, you know, lots of, like, very, like, feathers and very brightly colored clothing.
Peacocks.
Yeah. As a soldier, first of all, you had a uniform, and our uniform is going to be much more grandiose. We have more money than you people do. We're of higher birth. So our soldiers are decorated with the honor that is bestowed on the greatest army there is. We're a sparkling jewel. All of that. Our sabers are polished. Shiny and bright colors. Think about how birds, it's the same thing, you know.
And until Vietnam, those motherfuckers started hiding in holes in the ground and shooting at us.
Yeah. And the Brits always just wore khaki. The Brits were just fucking down home khaki motherfuckers. They were just like, yeah, you guys wear all your stuff. We're going to wear our khakis.
I wonder who figured out hunting, like camo for hunting. Like, who was the first person to invent camo?
I think it goes back to millennia. I think
you
people,
think so?
Fuck yeah.
Like leaves and shit, right?
Yes, they were covering themselves in leaves, waiting in the cold for dinner.
Fuck.
Yeah.
They made it. You didn't.
It's true.
You didn't get to this point. Trust me. Trust me. You with your fucking ironic glasses on that don't even have a real lens. Like, people wear, like, clear glass.
Fashion has always been another thing that we... Fashion has always been there. But people's appearance, I mean, you know, if you look at indigenous cultures that have had very little contact, they're still putting bones to their nose and wearing feathers and peacocking men and women.
But the eyeglass one is one of the weirdest ones.
Well, a friend of mine's mother, he couldn't get a job. It wasn't a friend of mine. It's a friend of mine told me the story about this kid. He's Puerto Rican, and he couldn't get a job. And his mother... said he'd been on, he was a great student, he's a great guy, just couldn't get a job, was trying to work on Wall Street. His mother went out and bought him a pair of glasses.
Wow.
Just clear glasses. And he got every job he went in for. He had glasses on, they went, this guy must read, and he got every fucking job. His mother was genius. He said, I'm gonna put some glasses on you, watch this.
It's also the only handicap that is sexually arousing.
100%.
Like men like a secretary looking chick with glasses on.
Women like men with glasses.
Really? Do they?
Oh yeah.
Tell me about it. What do you do? You put glasses on?
I had to
Elton
use
John style?
I have to use my reading glasses sometimes, which I resist all the time. And my wife went, that's really sexy.
Oh, she likes old dudes.
She likes gray in my beard.
She likes guys that are dying.
Loves old guys. She loves old men. She loves them wrinkly.
Dude,
wrinkles.
We're almost out of time. I understand that you're going to be in Sacramento doing your stand-up comedy this weekend, Brian. Tell us about it, and what can we expect at the Punchline?
I'm glad you asked, Joe. I'm going to be at the Sacramento Punchline, tearing it up this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I am under the impression, talking to TJ Dillashaw and Uriah Faber, and there's a chance they might come out and see me because they're friends of mine, and I couldn't be more excited about that. Yes, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Joe. And I want to say one more thing.
What?
You know I've got a podcast called The Fighter and the Kid.
I heard that it gets 1.5 million downloads a month. Is
that
true?
That's the rumor, and the rumor's true.
Wow.
More importantly, I'm going to be having... There was a documentary called Lady Valor, and I'm going to be having the Navy SEAL who became a woman, Kristen Beck, on our podcast, and I am very excited.
That's amazing.
Keep
the camera on him, Jamie. This is a surprise.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to record it soon. Jeez, Joe's taking his shirt off, and you've got a body. You look like a naked silverback.
This is a surprise, dude.
Oh, sorry, buddy. Oh, I love it. Oh, okay, here we got the surprise coming, you guys. Christmas comes early, ladies and gentlemen. Our biggest promoter.
You're looking at not just a shirt, but a cultural phenomenon. This shirt, this Master Kim's 1984 Taekwondo National Champion shirt from The Fighter and the Kid, they sold 800 of them in about 6 minutes.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen.
They flew off the shelves.
Can't keep them in stock.
They bought new ones. They were gone by the end of the day.
There it is.
Twice restocked shirt. This motherfucker right here, a cultural phenomenon that is The Fighter and the Kid. Now, what does that feel? We're running out of time, but that's got to be trippy, like, to know that you guys are, that show is taking off,
It
man.
Really is. It really is.
It's a good fucking podcast.
I appreciate it, and a lot of it has to do with your support, and we just try to keep it inspiring and funny. And, it's one of those things, I think it's chemistry. I'm just doing it and showing up, and it's just, you never expect it to be. You're not managing success. I just show up and do it. But I think Brennan and I have a great chemistry.
It's very unusual.
He's hilarious.
You guys
he
are
pushes
hilarious
me.
Together, too.
Yeah.
It's a very, very funny chemistry.
We crack each other up.
Yeah.
And we try to stay as authentic as we can.
That's rare, and both really good dudes, you know? And that comes through in the show. Like, I know a lot of people that, like, on the underground, especially, like, that guy won me over, fucker.
Right.
Like, they listen to The Fighter and the Kid, and, like, get used to him. I'm telling you. Like, I've been telling Dana White this forever. I'm like, the guy's a great guy.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
well,
like, you gotta get to know him.
Brendan doesn't take himself seriously. He's very aware of his faults, and he's always working on them.
He's
a guy
so
who constantly
too.
Grows. Yeah.
He's so silly.
Silly.
He says hilarious shit.
Did you see the Instagram I posted of him wearing that hat?
Yes,
that little
sailor hat.
I was like, I can't be friends with you. He kept going, all hands on dick. All hands on dick, everybody. Like, we don't even know the people we're playing volleyballs with. He's got his hands on his knees, this giant UFC fighter going, all hands on dick.
Oh, that's always fun for everybody else involved.
He's a silly
goose. On the outside trying to figure out what's happening.
Yeah.
Look at him with his fucking hat on.
Making his macho face.
So, with his cauliflower ear.
Yeah.
He's so silly.
Yeah.
He's a funny dude. Fighter and the Kid, it's available on iTunes. It's a hilarious podcast. It really is fun.
Thank you, brother.
Get some great guests. And Lady Valor, that's going to be very interesting.
Yes.
I want to talk to her. I want to have her on. That's an insane story. And I'll ask better questions than you. So what I'll do is I'll just watch you guys fuck it up first.
I'll come in.
I've been trying to think of what to ask her. I'm so excited, man.
Oh, yeah. We went turkey hunting. Yeah. This podcast is supposed to be about that.
I know. We missed it.
We also did a podcast last week, folks. If you want to get it, it's available on iTunes. It's just in the car with an iPhone. Just Brian and I driving, having fun talking shit for like 2 hours or something.
Talking important
shit. The Fighter and the Kid podcast, the Punchline in Sacramento this weekend. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Friday,
Thursday,
Saturday?
Friday, Saturday.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday. A fucking phenomenal club. If you live up there and you haven't been there, it's an iconic club. It's one of the best setup clubs in the country.
Yeah.
And this weekend, Brian motherfucking Callen, Brian Callen with a Y, B-R-Y-A-N Callen on Twitter. Much love.
Sacramento.
You fuckers. See you soon.
Punchline Sac.
Punchline Sacramento. All right, that's it. I'm at the Cod Theater May 22nd with Tom Segura and Tony Hinchcliffe, the Cod Theater at the MGM in Vegas. That's all I got coming up. See ya. Oh, this weekend in Montreal, but it's sold out. All right, much love, you fuckers. See you soon.